Welcome to Cal State University, Domingo Hills. We're coming live to you locally on channel LA 36 on cable, as well as worldwide on the internet. I'm your instructor, Sadullah Khan, instructor for the Social Behavioral Science Department, SBS 318 course on Islamic culture and civilization. Today is session 11 of the SBS 318 program that we are having, 11 of 13. And the theme for today is Muslim presence in the West. I'll also be giving the assignment later in the program, the final assignment, the major assignment that is due for those students who are taking this course for credit. And I hope that you have benefited thus far from the discussion that we've had in the past 10 programs. And hopefully for those viewers who are not doing the course for credit, have benefited and somewhat enhanced the understanding about Islamic culture and about Islam's contribution towards global civilization. We also will be having two guests later on from two different organizations and institutions involved in grassroots work to get a feel and understanding of what Muslims are doing and what they are participating in and how they are engaged in building a better society and community right here in Los Angeles in the USA. Let me begin by making reference to the fact that much of the research for today's program and very often reference for some of the previous programs has been the Oxford History of Islam, a book by Professor John Esposito, which is a combination of articles by various academics and scholars throughout the world, more specifically Islamic and Judeo-Christian Abrahamic faith scholars here in America. And the book is titled The Oxford History of Islam. It is edited by John Esposito from Georgetown University. And let me begin by quoting what Professor Esposito had said in the introduction of that book. Although Islam is the youngest of the major world religions with 1.2 billion followers, Islam is the second largest and fastest growing religion in the world. To speak of the world of Islam today is to refer not only to countries that stretch from North Africa to Southeast Asia, but also to Muslim communities that exist across the globe. Thus, for example, Islam is the second or third largest religion in Europe and in the Americas. Both the Muslim world and the West have experienced the impact of Islam politically, culturally, and demographically. Events in the contemporary Muslim world have led to an explosion of interest and scholarly work on Islam and the Muslim world. Much of this work in religion, history, and the social sciences has contributed towards the redressing of earlier imbalances of coverage and of stereotyping. The cognitive, ideological, political, and demographic map of the Muslim world changed dramatically in the second half of the 20th century. Modern nation-states emerged from centuries of European colonization, often as a result of successful independence movements. However, contemporary Muslim history challenged the expectation that modernization would result in the progressive westernization and secularization of societies. Secularization of society has not proved a necessary precondition for social, economic, and political development. Now, Islam today is the dominant symbolic and ideological force in the Muslim world, informing social institutions, whether education, clinics, hospitals, social welfare services, whether it be bank, economic institutions, and politics as well. In contrast to the expectations of only a few decades ago, Islam, Islamic symbols, ideology, organizations, and institutions have re-emerged as a significant force in public life. Mainstream Islamic organizations have become major social and political actors in society. The reassertion of Islam produced new Islamic republics in Iran, Sudan, and in Afghanistan. At the same time, Islamic movements emerged as the major opposition in Algeria, in Egypt, in Kuwait, in Yemen, Tunisia, Jordan, Pakistan, Palestine, Kashmir, Central Asia, and Bosnia and Kosovo in Europe. We take a short snippet from a ABC program where John Esposito speaks somewhat about Islam and also some of the Muslim people who are interviewed. We can have a look at that.
Polish American or Chinese American or Vietnamese American, we all basically have come from, our heritage comes from another part of the world.
The oldest Muslim communities in America are in fact in places like Cedar Rapids and Quincy, Massachusetts. And we're not aware of that.
Cedar Rapids, Iowa, it turns out, is home to the oldest mosque in America, built by families like the Igrams and the Ossies, whose forefathers and mothers came to the Midwest from the Middle East nearly 100 years ago. Dentist Mo Igram's parents were among them.
There were several families in Cedar Rapids at the time that established a house of worship and a social hall. Also, it was used for Arabic school and religious school for us.
Cedar Rapids Muslim community has grown and prospered and put down its own unique roots. It has outgrown the old Islamic center and constructed a new one, which is the focal point of the community.
Allahu Akbar.
Especially during religious festivals like Eid, which comes at the end of the observance of Ramadan, when for a month devout Muslims consume neither food nor drink during daylight hours.
Fasting is prescribed for you.
There is nothing alien, after all, about prayer services or Sunday school, nor could anything be more American than a potluck brunch.
Just because some people treat us as Muslim fundamentalists or give us a hard time.
The concerns of American Muslims, says Sunday school teacher Tima Schmeichel, are the concerns of American Christians and Jews.
We do talk a lot about the effects of alcohol and drugs because of the society that the children are in right now. Not just Muslim children, all children. Our society right now is just a little crazy, and we really do need to get back to taking a look at our morals, and we really need to get back and get things straightened out.
I don't think that the values that a Muslim espouses as being important in raising their family are any different than anybody else.
What happened, Tari?
They are concerned, in a phrase, about family values. Lila Igram, a third-generation American Muslim, has been hearing about such things all her life.
The strict rules are things that a person would just... You would not do things if you're just following your common sense. So those kinds of things aren't hard to stay away from for several people. For instance, alcohol, drugs, premarital sex.
If that sounds more like us than them, it may just be that most Americans don't know much about Islam.
They don't have the sense that Muslims are us, part and parcel of our society, and indeed part and parcel of the religious tradition, that in fact we are talking about a Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition.
But for all their...
In one of his other books, Professor Esposito, who we have just seen speaking there, commenting on the idea of them and us, and the kind of divide that people have, they assume that Muslim implies Eastern, and more specifically Middle Eastern, something that we have been at pains to explain throughout our 10 sessions thus far. In one of his books, it's called Islam, the Straight Path, which is a book that I prescribe for this course, in fact. He writes under the title Islam in the West. He says, despite their common monotheistic roots, the history of Christianity and Islam has more often than not been marked by confrontation rather than peaceful coexistence and dialogue. For the Christian West, Islam is the religion of the sword. For Muslims, the Christian West is epitomized by the armies of the Crusades. Islam's universal mission had resulted in the spread of Muslim rule over Christian territories and Christian hearts. Further on, Professor Esposito writes this in his book, Islam, the Straight Path. While conversions were initially slow, by the 11th century, large numbers of Christians living under Muslim rule were converting to Islam. Even those who had remained Christian were becoming Arabicized, adopting Arabic language and manners. The European Christian response was, with a few exceptions, hostile, intolerant, and belligerent. This attitude, writes Professor Esposito, was preserved and perpetuated in literature such as the Divine Comedy, where Dante consigned Muhammad to the lowest level of hell. Christian fears were fully realized as Islam became a world power and civilization, while the West staggered and stagnated in its dark ages. By the 11th century, Christendom's response to Islam took two forms. Firstly, the struggle to reconquer, or the Reconquista, Spain from 1000 to 1492, and in Italy and Sicily in 1061, and the undertaking of another series of Christian holy wars, or the Crusades, from 1095 to 1453. Professor Esposito further elaborates, two myths pervade Western perception of the Crusades. First, that the Crusades were simply motivated by a religious desire to liberate Jerusalem. And second, that Christendom ultimately triumphed. Jerusalem was a sacred city for all three Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. When the Arab armies took Jerusalem in 638, they occupied a center whose shrines had made a major pilgrimage site in Christendom. Churches and the Christian population were left unmolested. Jews, long banned from living there by Christian rulers, were permitted to return, live, and worship in the city of Solomon and David. Further on, Professor Esposito writes, Muslims proceeded to build a shrine, the Dome of the Rock, and a mosque, the Al-Aqsa, near the area formerly occupied by Herod's temple and close by the Wailing Wall. 5 centuries of peaceful coexistence elapsed before political events and an imperial papal power play led to centuries-long series of so-called holy wars that pitted Christendom against Islam and left an enduring legacy of misunderstanding and distrust. I repeat the last part. 5 centuries of peaceful coexistence elapsed before political events and an imperial papal power play led to centuries-long series of so-called holy wars that pitted Christendom against Islam and left an enduring legacy of misunderstanding and distrust. Let's take a look at a snippet from the PBS Islam Empire of Faith regarding the Crusades.
As Europeans made their way from the cold stone of their northern castles into the glorious Muslim cities of southern Spain, they couldn't help but be impressed. In the green hills above Granada was a palace of startling elegance, a shining example of the richness and sophistication Islam brought to medieval Europe. It is called the Alhambra.
The Alhambra is perhaps the most famous example of Islamic architecture to most Westerners. It is the best remaining example of what a medieval Muslim palace would have looked like.
Echoed in the finely carved geometric plasterwork and marble pillars is a vanished lifestyle of extraordinary luxury.
Thank you.
The Alhambra reveals the pinnacle of Islamic culture and urbanity.
The beauty of the Alhambra is not so much in the individual details. No, it's more the combination of everything. That is, this wonderful sort of orchestrated interplay of different textures and surfaces, of light and space and water playing inside and outside of buildings. It's almost like a symphony of different elements that are very carefully brought together to provide exquisite enjoyment.
Here, the Muslim elite relished the good life. Reposing on lush carpets, surrounded by perfume and music, the privileged few debated the nature of God, the subtleties of Greek philosophy, or the most recent mathematical revelations from India, while they dined on spiced delicacies served on Chinese porcelains. They strolled the grounds through gardens irrigated by complex gravity-fed water systems. How far Muhammad's followers had come from the life of desert nomads. How distant they felt from the rest of the European continent they now shared. Christian Europe, due north, was struggling on through the Dark Ages. But at the dawn of the 11th century, a tragedy in Jerusalem would put Muslims and European Christians on a collision course. Jerusalem was ruled by an Egyptian caliph, an infamous man named Al-Hakim.
Al-Hakim was certainly a deviation from the norm. Clinically speaking, I suppose today we'd regard him as a madman, as someone who was simply insane.
For 200 years, Christian holy places in Jerusalem had been respected and protected by Muslim rulers. In 1009, the Egyptian ruler Al-Hakim broke with that tradition. He ordered the holiest church in Christendom destroyed.
And horror of horrors, he burnt down the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. Now, nobody knows quite why he did it, and you can have your own theories about it, but the fact of the matter was that that sent shivers of terror and anxiety through Christendom.
In a way, of course, Al-Hakim was the one exception that proved the rule for Christians, that Christians had been speaking of for centuries, of Muslims as intolerant, mad, slavering heretics who simply could not be expected to abide by the rules of civilized human beings.
The fact that Al-Hakim's successor rebuilt the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, it was done by 1048 with Byzantine help, didn't cut any ice. There was this perception now that things were not going well in the Holy Land.
In Europe, anti-Muslim sentiment simmered. By 1095, it reached the boiling point. Pope Urban II spent most of that year traveling through France, imploring his feudal lords to unite in a campaign of bloodshed. Hasten to exterminate this vile race from the lands of your eastern brethren, the Pope demanded. Jerusalem is the navel of the world. She cries out to be liberated. Christ himself commands it.
So we've got a merging or a coming together of military service and religion, which served the purposes, if you like, of a pope who in 1095 made his famous call to crusade to rescue the endangered holy places in the East, and in particular Jerusalem.
In 1097, Muslim shepherds in Syria caught their first glimpse of a sight that would soon strike terror throughout the Holy Land. When the Crusaders struck, by sheer chance, the Arab Empire was at its most vulnerable, broken into feuding kingdoms and petty dynasties.
They couldn't have chosen a better moment, because the Muslim world was in a very fragmented state. The great rulers of the time had died, and into that power vacuum there came this most unexpected enemy, the Crusaders from Western Europe. Who would have thought that a new enemy would come to the Islamic world from that unexpected quarter? It was completely unprecedented. It was a real surprise. The Muslims didn't really know who they were. They thought they were just another lot of Byzantines who were coming, as usual, to be a nuisance and fight on the borders. They had no idea that there was this extraordinary surge of religious fervor and fanaticism coming from Western Europe, and that the aim of this group was Jerusalem.
History is haunted by days of incomprehensible horror. Few are darker than July 15, 1099, when the Crusaders entered Jerusalem.
The massacre must have been terrible. The fear, the fleeing of the population. It must have been horrendous.
From a letter to the Pope from the Crusaders. If you want to know what was done to the enemies we found in the city, know this. Our men rode in the blood of the Saracens up to the knees of their horses.
They saw the holy city and they were in a state of exultation. And perhaps that's why, when they flooded through the gates of the city, that they were fired up with fanaticism and zeal, and that's why there was this terrible massacre in the name of Christendom. It was a blot on the name of Christendom in the Muslim view, and justifiably so.
Even Christians weren't spared. At the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, dozens of worshippers from Eastern sects were massacred. To the Crusaders, they were nothing more than foreigners. The Christian chronicles record the carnage. The Saracens, who were still alive, dragged the dead ones out and made huge piles of them. Such a slaughter of pagans no one has ever seen or heard of. The pyres they made were like pyramids.
They shocked the Muslim world when they came. There are a number of extremely moving lamentations in poetry which date from that period, and the Arab poets of the time talk about the feelings of anguish and terror which the Crusaders, or the Franks as they're called in the Arab sources, caused the local people, the old women, the young girls, those who were cloistered away in their houses are trembling with fear. The whole imagery is that of the rape of their land and the terrible impurities caused by these barbarian infidels coming into their sacred space.
We have mingled blood with flowing tears, and there is no room left in us for pity. To shed tears is man's worst weapon when the swords stir up the embers of war. When blood has been spilt, when sweet girls must hide their lovely faces in their hands for shame. The First Crusade was over. Of the 100,000 men who began the campaign, most would eventually return to Europe, having had only a glimpse of Muslim life. The job of occupying Jerusalem and the surrounding countryside fell to the 20,000 who remained, indefinitely.
A scene from PBS, a snippet from PBS, Islam, Empire, Faith, dealing with the Crusades. Now, when we talk about the Muslim encounter with the West, according to Professor Yvonne Haddad from Georgetown University, professor of Islamic history and Christian-Muslim relations, she says the Muslim encounter with the West dates back to the beginning of Islam's, from the beginning of Islam. As Islam spread, and from the Byzantine Empire in Southwest Asia and North Africa, large segments of Eastern Christian churches, the Byzantines, Jacobites, Copts, Gregorians, and Nestorians, came in contact with Muslims. These encounters generated a variety of experiences, ranging from peaceful coexistence and cooperation to mutual vilification and also, at times, armed conflict. It also helped craft a corpus of polemical literature written by both Muslims and Christians, each seeking to demonstrate and proclaim the truth and superiority of their own tradition. Each group faulted the other for basing their faith on falsified scriptures as well as proclaiming errant doctrines. Muslim expansion from North Africa into Western Europe was stopped at Poitiers in 732, but the Ottomans in the east kept probing into Europe for several centuries until they were halted after the siege of Vienna in 1683. The second major encounter with the West was with what we have seen, the Catholic Crusades and the Reconquista. Although the Crusades took place at the periphery of the Islamic Empire and seemed to have been concerned with containing and weakening Eastern Orthodoxy as much as Islam, the bloody story of the Crusades sacking Antioch and Jerusalem and slaughtering all the inhabitants is increasingly depicted in today's Islamic literature as one of the Western warriors consumed with Christian hatred, bent on eradicating Muslims and also usurping Muslim land. Similarly, the leaders of the Inquisition, armed with the assurance of Christian truth and virtue, in an effort to de-Islamize Spain, offered Muslims the option of conversion to Christianity, expulsion, or execution. In the process, they all but eliminated the Muslim presence in Western Europe, as the last Muslims were expelled in 1609. However, we have seen the Crusades, and as Professor Esposito mentioned, 5 centuries of somewhat rivalry and misunderstanding, and of course very often peaceful coexistence until the Crusades, really speaking. And thereafter also, there was a response. A great Muslim leader arose by the name of Salahuddin Ayyubi, who was a Kurd, and we see a snippet from PBS referring to the Muslim taking back of Jerusalem by Salahuddin. Let's have a look.
After almost 100 years of broken treaties and sporadic fighting, the Muslims reached a turning point in their struggles against the Crusaders. It came in the person of one of Islam's most celebrated figures. His name was Salah ud-Din, but the West would remember him and come to revere him as Saladin.
There is certainly one thing that we must recognize about Saladin, and that is that he was successful where many others of his faith and of his part of the world had not been. that he possessed one unusual feature. In addition to his intelligence and his robust physical strength, he certainly seems to have been a great inspirer of his military followers.
In 1187, Saladin amassed an army of 12,000 mounted warriors and lured the Crusaders out of Jerusalem onto a plain between two hills called the Horns of Hattin. On the evening of July 3rd, after a long march, the Crusaders camped on a barren hillside.
There was nothing but a waterless terrain. And we're talking about July, we're talking about the Middle East, we're talking about incredible heat and no water.
As dawn approached, Saladin's men set fire to the tall grass, and a strong wind carried the flames into the Christian encampment.
And very soon they found themselves surrounded, as in the Muslim tactic, by their enemy. And panic set in.
The flames bore down on them and the heat became intense, Saladin's secretary wrote. The people of the Trinity were consumed by the fire of flames, the fire of thirst, and the fire of arrows.
The army of the Crusaders was totally decimated. The victory at Hattin was a real turning point for Saladin. It meant that he could then proceed to take Jerusalem later on that year.
3 months later, Saladin entered Jerusalem. For the first time in almost a century, the call to prayer floated over the holy city once again.
Allahu Akbar. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah.
And yet, remarkably, Saladin leveled no retaliation against Christians or their holy places. In the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, Mass was celebrated as usual. Saladin also decreed that Christians who wished to could leave the city with their property. Those who chose to stay would be allowed to worship freely.
When his reputation reached Western Europe of the way he had behaved in Jerusalem over the conquest, he gradually became the most famous Muslim of all time.
Saladin's victory did not put an end to Western aspirations in the Near East. Other crusades would follow, though, as with the first, they would hardly have an impact on the larger Islamic culture. The crusaders would eventually be driven from their citadels along the coast and return to Europe. Their only lasting legacy, a few abandoned castles. But the returning crusaders found themselves changed by their contact with Islamic culture. The long-term impact on European life would be profound.
They were just...
By the 13th century, the Crusades degenerated into inter-Christian wars, papal wars against its Christian enemies who were denounced as heretics and schismatics. The result was a weakening rather than a strengthening of Christendom. And as Roger Savoy has observed, an ironic but undeniable result of the Crusades was the deterioration of the position of Christian minorities in the Holy Land. Formerly, these minorities had been accorded rights and privileges under Muslim rule. But after the establishment of the Latin Kingdom, they found themselves treated as loathsome schismatics. In an effort to obtain relief from persecution by their fellow Christians, many abandoned their Nestorian or Monophysite beliefs and adopted either Catholicism or, supreme irony, became Muslim. Constantinople fell in 1453 before Turkish Muslim conquerors, and the Byzantine capital was renamed Istanbul and later became the seat of the Ottoman Empire, which was the last empire, major empire, that the Muslim world or the Islamic world had, and which collapsed in the 1920s with the establishment of the Republic of Turkey. Now, so the first encounter was from the outset when Islam, of course, there were Muslims in some Christians in Medina, which the Prophet met, who came from Najran, and we dealt with that. So there were encounters with Christians. One of the Prophet's cousin-in-laws, his wife's nephew or cousin, was Waraqah bin Nawfal, who was a Christian priest, as an example. So there was that kind of contact. And of course, when Muslims came to Abyssinia, into Africa, to seek refuge under a Christian king, and as we have seen last week in the program, when Islam went to Africa, and the first place to give refuge to Islam was Africa, and it was under a Christian king. That was the first encounter. The second encounter, major encounter as such, or second phase of encountering, was that of the Crusades, and that unfortunately has somewhat determined, rather than the first one, which is perhaps the best example of cooperation and coexistence, the second one was a bloody one, and somewhat still instills in people's mind the impression of East versus West, Christian versus Muslim, and this is very unfortunate. I see we have a call on the line. Please go ahead, state your name and your question briefly, please.
Hi there, how are you doing?
Very well.
This is Joe, I'm calling you from East Los Angeles again.
Go ahead, Joe.
And I see you're bringing up the issue of the Crusades.
Yes, Joe.
Now, you think this was an unprovoked attack, or why do you think the Crusaders even initiated the Crusades? You think it was that they had some expansionist ideals? The reason for the Crusades is a very simple one, and I explained to you this the first time out. The Sultan, the king of that area, Palestine, decided to destroy the Church of the Holy Sepulcher. He destroyed the church. He burned the church down.
Right.
The Church of the Holy Sepulcher was destroyed by an Arab ruler. This was an act of war, all-out war. This is something that is unforgivable. The Pope was infuriated, and the Vatican, it took the Vatican 60 years after the church was destroyed. It took the Vatican 60 years to get all the feudal lords to come together and form the 100,000 man army to go in there and basically depopulate that area of Arabs, because basically the Pope decided that they could not trust the Arabs, they could not trust the holy sites, Christian holy sites, in Arab hands. And that was the main reason the place was depopulated by heathens, okay? Now, for good, bad, or indifferent, the Crusaders didn't go in there because they wanted to expand their empire. They went in there in defense of their holy sites. And the reason they had to do what they had to do was because their holy sites was in peril. They felt that the Arabs were destroying their holy sites. And you can't do that. If you have no respect for the holy sites, you're asking for war. It's very simple. And this other thing about the Inquisition that you stated in Spain about either convert to Christianity or off with your head or get expelled. Well, the Muslims did the same thing. They have the same practice. You either convert to Islam or off with your head. You know, it's very simple. Both the Christians and the Islamic, you know, back in those days, that same thing with Wahhabism is doing too. I mean, they have the same belief. Either you convert or die, you know? And it's the same mentality. You can't have the Muslim world as have supreme morals over the Christian world. They both get the same practice of converting or off with their heads. It was the same thing.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you very much for the call. I think if you looked very carefully, your point very well taken there, Joe. First of all, yes, it's very correct that and if you look at the video snippet we showed, and that's why I deliberately showed it, the caliph was based in Egypt at that time. He was al-Hakim. And yes, he instructed that the church be burned down. And of course, the church was burned down, and it was, of course, a despicable act, and it is condemned, of course, no question about that. That virtually is a declaration of war against against whom? Against the Christian people. But the question I'm trying to, that we need to also understand, it's unacceptable what he did. And don't forget, as was mentioned, that his successor rebuilt the church, even before the Crusades came in there. So that we need to understand that, number one. So the destruction of a particular building by a corrupt ruler or by a deviant ruler, which Al-Hakim distinctly seemed to have been, specifically in this case, because remember, Muslims were ruling that place well before him for 500 years. And 500 years, and as Esposito said, as Ibn Haddad, both well-known Christian scholars and scholars of Christian Islamic studies here in America at Georgetown University have clearly indicated that yes, 500 years of coexistence, most of it was peaceful, and many Christians were living in Jerusalem at that time, and many Muslims were living in Jerusalem at that time. For the prince, for the Caliph Al-Hakim to have done that was a despicable and unpardonable act. That must be said from the outset, and there's no excuse for that. Then, when his successor rebuilt the church, that needs also to be taken into account, that before the Crusaders came, it was rebuilt. And then, when the Crusaders did come into Jerusalem, you must understand when you use the word Arab, and I think after 10, I'm sure Joe, you've been watching most of my programs, you've been calling in most of the time, I think we must get beyond this prejudice of Arab, because there are many Arabs who are Christian too. So there are particular people, there are Arabs who are Jews, there are Arabs who are Christian, they happen to be Arabs, they're all Semites who are living there, by the way. So we need to be very clear about these kind of terms and terminology. Jews are Semites, Muslim Arabs are also Semites. So be aware of that. And not all Arabs are Muslims, not all Muslims are Arabs, nor all, there are also non-Muslims who are Arabs, by the way. So don't forget there were Christians living in Jerusalem who were Arabs. So to say they don't trust the Arabs is a very general statement, and specifically in light of what's happening nowadays in the world with this kind of prejudice and stereotyping, is very dangerous to generalize in that way. But Al-Hakim was definitely wrong. That sparked the outrage that led to the Pope Urban declaring that, look, we need to do something about this guy. He was removed, by the way, and he was replaced. His successor rebuilt the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And then, as we have seen, the point is that when the Crusades came in, they killed Muslim, Christians and Jews for a building. So you need to understand that. You know, it wasn't they destroyed a particular church or a particular mosque of the Muslims. They destroyed the entire inhabitants. So that's very, very serious, and that in the name of religion. So we need to understand this very, very, very clearly. And yes, you are correct. As regards that sometimes there were times in history where Christians as well as Muslims, not necessarily according to Christian scripture beliefs, or not necessarily according to Islamic beliefs, but did demand from the conquered, you either accept our faith, leave the country or be killed. That did happen. It happened in Jerusalem. Salahuddin Ayyubi, when he conquered Jerusalem, did not do that, by the way, as evidenced by the PBS tape and as evidenced by history. So be very cautious. Yes, I'm very proud, Joe, that at least you owned up for once that some people are saying, oh, Muslims are not the only ones who put the sword to the neck. There were people of other faiths who did likewise, and I thank you for that. So yes, Al-Hakim was distinctly wrong. And he was condemned, his act is condemned and unpardonable, and any such act are despicable acts and should be condemned. The Quran makes it very clear that they should not destroy places of worship, and churches, mosques and synagogues and monasteries are mentioned by name as places not to be destroyed. In fact, it's an obligation for Muslims to defend it in chapter 22 of the Quran, and Al-Hakim despicably did the opposite, and he's condemned for that. Church was rebuilt and it was preserved. When the Crusaders came in, it was re-established, and not only the Muslims were killed or the Arabs were killed, all those were there, Christian, Jews and non-Catholic Christians, all of them were also killed, by the way, so we need to understand that. So this is the irony and the tragedy. The third encounter, the first one, as we mentioned, was marked by the encounter very early, where the Muslims went, for example, to Abyssinia to seek refuge. The second one, of course, was the Crusade. Unfortunately, seemed to be the defining one. The third encounter, according to Professor Ibn Haddad, professor of Islamic history and Christian-Muslim relations, professor at Georgetown University, a Christian professor, writes, the third encounter is marked by Western colonial expansion into Muslim territory following the fall of Granada in 1492. In this phase, Muslims have encountered the West as a triumphant, conquering, and an imperial presence. The colonial experience that initially pitted various European powers against one another in their quest to subjugate Muslims and monopolize the economic resources lasted until after the end of the Second World War. So another 600 years almost, or 500 and some odd years of, again, Western domination of lands in Africa and Middle East and the Far East, most of them who happened to be Muslim lands. By its end, Europeans were able to create imaginary lines in the sand. This is the words of Professor Yvonne Haddad in the book, The History, the Oxford History of Islam, edited by John Esposito. So I'm quoting from this. I'm trying to avoid quoting from Islamic or Muslim sources regarding the Crusades in order to give as far as possible a balanced view. So, or an unbiased view as far as possible. By its end, Europe was able to create imaginary lines in the sand, writes Professor Haddad, parceling out Muslim territories in a variety of schemes, carving up three Islamic empires, the Ottoman, the Safavid, and the Mughal, into what is today some 15 nation states, members of the Organization of Islamic Conference. Meanwhile, more than one-fourth of the Muslims in the world continue to live under non-Islamic rule. The colonial experience appears to have left a mark on the consciousness of those who were colonized. Islamist literature increasingly depicts the West as obsessed with combating Islam on all fronts. The West is often portrayed as marshalling its forces to launch a more pernicious attack under the guise of civilizing the Muslims and liberating them from backwardness and economic dependency, as seeking to subvert the influence of Islam on society by promoting the implementation of certain secular values as the foundation of political, economic, ideological, cultural, and social institutions. Professor Yvonne Haddad from Georgetown University further states, dubbed as a cultural attack, it is seen as a multifaceted attack launched by colonial bureaucrats and their willing cadre of Orientalists and missionaries. These bureaucrats and missionaries struggle to cast doubt about Islam by propagating the superiority of Western culture through such colonial institutions as schools and publishing firms whose goal was to separate Muslims from Islam. The current encounter, which is the third one, or the fourth one, sorry, the first one was the Muslims going to Africa and in the early time of Prophet Muhammad. Second one was the Crusades. The third one was colonization, colonialism, by the way, which was not necessarily a Christian thing. We need to understand that. But were done by people who were very, very well steeped or rather representing Christianity or were Christian people. So this is unfortunate, and no one should confuse colonialism in itself with Christianity, but though the colonialists were Christians. And unfortunately, the experience in Africa has been very often the colonialists sent in missionaries and established missionary homes and institutions before the colonialists came in. The history of Africa is replete with this, unfortunately. So the current encounter, still in progress, the fourth one, is a byproduct of World War II. While this encounter has been conditioned and shaped during the third quarter of the 20th century by the heritage of the post-war relationship between communism and capitalism, is also marked by two distinct features. The first is the assumption of world leadership by the United States, with the consequent creation and the empowerment of the State of Israel and the invention of a Judeo-Christian worldview. The second is the emigration and settlement of Muslims and their acquisition of citizenship in the West, in Western Europe, as well as in such established regions of European migration as Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Latin America, South Africa, and the US. Professor Haddad writes further, the composition of the Muslim communities in various nations of Western Europe is in part a byproduct of earlier relations between European nations and the Muslim world, as well as the European expansion into Muslim territories during the 19th and 20th centuries. It is also conditioned by the predatory political, economic, and cultural relationships that were developed during the colonial period. Now, when we look at Islam, maybe in the West or in Europe as such, we need to understand that how religions that originated in the same area, in the Middle East, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, how one is termed Eastern and Western. Despite Islam being all over the world, 1.2 billion followers all over the world, the fastest growing faith in much of Europe, the fastest growing faith in America, over 6 million in America, second largest religion in America, still this perception, this persisting perception that Islam is Eastern and Christianity is seen as Western, and Judaism an ally of Christianity, a Judeo-Christian worldview. And despite all three belonging to the Abrahamic tradition, Islam is somewhat seen as something more Eastern than Western, or something that is other than the norm, as Professor Esposito mentioned in his interview early on. Muslims, as you have noticed, have been in Europe, in southern Spain, southern France, from 711 already, and were well established there until 1492. Their legacy to Spain, and this is an article, Islamic Dynamism, this is an article by Professor Denny writing here. The legacy to Spain served to raise it to the status of a world power for a century or two. Muslim legacy to Spain reached magnificent proportions in learning, in architecture, and both cultural and scientific contribution. Muslim Spain served as a magnet for scholars and traders from Northern and Western Europe. Yet the Crusades and their aftermath managed to reduce the number of Muslims in Spain to a few thousands, who survived only by keeping their faith a secret. Sicily at one time in the 9th century was also a Muslim state, as was Crete. Islam was active and prosperous as a community in Hungary from the 10th to the 13th century, and also in Bosnia, Albania, and Bulgaria. Albania has always been a country in Europe with a Muslim majority, approximately 70%. However, of course, strongly curtailed under communist rule, but nonetheless, up till now, still the majority of people who are Albanians are Muslim. And the first community to establish a religious center in America in the early 1900s were Albanian Muslims. Though the first mosque as such was Cedar Rapids in Iowa, which we have seen, but the first establishment of a Muslim community center, not a mosque in itself, but a community center, was built by Albanian Muslims who came from Albania to America in the first decade of the last century. So, when we look at Europe, we find a very clear evidence that in Western Europe, for example, great concentration of Muslims in Great Britain, in France, where Islam is the second largest religion and the fastest growing, as well as in Germany. And each of these countries has a population of Muslims well over 2 million. So we see that Islam from the outset came into Europe, or the Western world, for want of a better word, with the Islamic advance from the Arabian Peninsula through Palestine and North Africa into Spain and southern France. It's the second largest religion, as I mentioned, in France and possibly in England, and still today a large concentration of Muslims in Germany, in Belgium, Bulgaria, and of course countries like Kosovo, Albania, and Bosnia are still majority Muslim countries. There are said to be approximately 35 to 40 million Muslims in Europe today. Now, just to look at some of the one or two of the countries in particular, until the communists take over in 1944, 70% of the people in Albania professed Islam. In 1967, religion was abolished and Muslim leadership was purged. In 1976, the constitution prohibited religious organizations. Recently, the government has been more open, of course, to religious expression. In Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia as one country, Muslim populations included Albanians, Macedonians, Montenegrins, Serbs, and Turks. Most of them, of course, lived in Bosnia-Herzegovina, which suffered a terrible fate, of course, as we know, in 2 decades ago, and in fact, in the last 20 years, with the atrocities perpetrated by Serbs against the Muslim population. Of course, both are European. Now, when we look at America, and last week we dealt with Islam via Africa into America, and we looked at some of the milestones in American Islamic history, and evidence of the fact that some people preceded Columbus, people from West Africa, who were from Muslim lands like Mali and Senegal, who came to this part of the world well before Columbus. And there's evidence of Mansa Abu Bakr of Mali, the Sultan of Mali, traveling to the Gulf of Mexico, well documented in West African literature, and well known in Africa, of course, and somewhat not so well known in the Western world, about his travel to what is now the Gulf of Mexico in 1312. Also, that in 1492, when Christopher Columbus arrived on the shores of the Bahamian island named Guanahani, probably Guanahani, what was renamed San Salvador, there was at least one Muslim navigator from West Africa, a guide to Columbus. Don't forget, prior to Columbus coming here, Muslims ruled Spain for over 500 years. In 1717, the arrival of enslaved Africans, most of whom were from West Africa, and many of them who were adherents of the Islamic faith, as is clearly evidenced by the great historic work of Dr. Alex Haley in his book Roots. We have evidence of outstanding personalities, as we mentioned last week, of Prince Ayuba Diallo of Senegal, who arrived here. He was a prince who was eventually freed by James Oglethorpe and returned back to Senegal, and on his way via England was asked by Oxford University to translate some manuscripts. He arrived back in Senegal in 1734, the caliber of some of these people. Another important event in the history of the first early people who were Muslim or were from Muslim background or embraced Islam, people from the Africas, Paul Kufi, a former Quaker, who became the first African-American to petition the end of slavery and was the first person to open a school to all races, and that was in Katihang Island in Massachusetts. Also in 1788, the Prince Abdurrahman Maudu of Mali, fluent in seven languages at the age of 17, was brought as a slave, kept as a slave for 40 years in Natchez, Mississippi, before he had returned back after the intervention of the King of Morocco and arrived back in February 1829 and died in Liberia 5 months after his return, after 40 years in slavery. And then, of course, Kunta Kinte of Gambia, the first African whose descendant, Dr. Alex Haley, was able to trace and document back his roots to Africa. We had people in the 1880s and 1890s, like the West Indian scholar, Dr. Edward Abdul Karim Blyden, who became the first pan-African leader to embrace Islam and influence many other leaders. We had Alexander Russell Webb, an Anglo-American, the first prominent Anglo-American who was a diplomat, an American to embrace Islam, and he was the U.S. diplomat to Philippines, and he was the first to bring Islam to the agenda in the corridors of Congress, and he wrote an article, Islam in America, in 1893, an article very, very relevant even today. His name was Alexander Russell Webb, W-E-B-B, Alexander Russell Webb. Then the outstanding thinker Marcus Garvey and people like Timothy Drew of Cardina, who established the Moody Science Temple in Newark, New York. Then in 1915, as I mentioned, the first establishment of the first effective regular congregational place for Muslims to meet was established in Biddeford, Maine, by the European Muslims who came here from Albania. And then the first Islamic association was established in Detroit, Michigan in 1922. A second Islamic center was established in 1928 in New York by Polish Muslims. So we see in the first 20 years of first 25 years of the previous century, of the 20th century, two communities from Europe, Western communities who came here, who happened to be Muslim, established early Islamic centers. So we need to understand this. Islam did not come here from the Middle East. It did not come here by the Arabs. The Arabs are not the majority of the Muslims, neither in the world nor in America. And of course, even in America, majority of Arabs are Christian. 48% of Arab Americans are Catholic. only half that number are Muslims. And this needs to be said very, very clearly. This perception of Middle East, the perception of Arabs needs to stop, because it somehow leads to a tremendous amount of stereotyping that everybody has to respond to some kind of guilt by association. The first official mosque, of course, as I mentioned, was established in Cedar Rapids in Iowa. Before I go further on milestones in American history, let's go to the line. I think we have a call on the line. Please go ahead. Ali, please go ahead.
Yes. My question is to you. I heard you talking about the Arab civilization in North Africa and throughout that part of the world, and the Christian crusades in that part of the world. One question I had, my answer is to you. You're talking about the Semitic people, or the Jews that's there now, and the Arab people. But you also missed out the Hamitic people that's in that area that's under Islamic rule. They don't even play in the arena of this thing. They are not Gentile people. Hamitic people has been in Egypt and throughout that land for millions of years, and why they are never brought up in your conversation. Yeah. And I think that, let me ask you one more question. Was that the Christian crusade, the Muslim that destroyed the Monophthonite church? Okay?
I didn't get the last part, Ali. Was the last part?
Was it the Muslim civilization or the Christian crusade that destroyed the Monophthonite church?
Which church?
The Monophthonite, the Kemet Church, the Hermetic Church.
I don't know, sir. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that part.
You don't know that?
I don't know the part of this particular question you're asking. But regarding the first part, I appreciate your comment. Of course, I in no way say that only people who are from Arabia or from Palestine or that area are the only Semitic people. I do agree with you. The point I was making is not that Semites are only Jewish or, in fact, only Arab. Because people who speak Aramaic, Arabic, Syriac, Hebrew, these are all Semitic people, understand that. And you are very correct, sir. If I give an impression, then I need to be rectified. And I thank you for rectifying that. If I give the impression that I'm only referring to Arabs and Jews as being Semitic people, I didn't mean that. I meant that in addition to Jewish people, there are others who are also Semitic people. And there's evidence of Semitic people, of course, distinctly in Ethiopia, as well as in southern Egypt, in Sudan, in the Somalia, in Djibouti. It is very correct. It's not a Middle Eastern thing in that sense, but people of that region. So you need to understand also, Semites are not necessarily limited to this part of the Red Sea and not on the other part of the Red Sea. I did not imply it's only Jewish and Arab. I meant it's beyond just Jewish. For example, I mentioned that Muslims are not only Arabs, but of course Muslims are also African and European and Far Eastern and Middle Eastern and Chinese and so on. So I'm not mentioning Chinese in specific. It doesn't mean I'm excluding the Chinese, but you are very correct. So if I give an impression that it only refers to Arabs or Jews, then I need to be corrected, and I appreciate your correction if I gave that impression. I thank you for the call, Ali. Thank you for clearing that point up. And of course, we made reference to spokesperson, great and articulate people like Malcolm X, formerly Malcolm Little, who embraced Islam in 1947 while in prison. And of course, influenced people like Muhammad Ali, one of the most well-known, if not the best-known personality in sports, and a recognized figure in the world, Muhammad Ali. And also, for example, we know that much later on, we found that Islam developed and spread. And there were various waves of immigrants who came in the 20s and 30s from different parts of Europe and the Middle East and so on and so forth. Some came as political exiles, some came to study, and many came to seek job opportunities and so on and so forth, which many who come from a previously colonized country felt it better for them to come out. And thus we have an establishment of a large Muslim population in many parts of the world. But need to understand that Islam did not come here purely as immigrants. Very often it came here before Columbus and was brought here also enslaved and enchained. I'd like to take a short snippet before we take a break. But before I do that, I want to just bring to your attention something which was beautifully captured in what was said by one of the scholars, Islamic scholars, one of the writers who said in the Oxford History of Islam, observers estimate that more than 80 million nations in Africa, Asia, and Eastern Europe are represented in the mosque communities of the U.S. This is the point that I think we need to bring across. Sorry, I need to rectify that. The reference says it's not a Muslim scholar. I'm quoting from Professor Yvonne Haddad again, a professor from Georgetown University of Islamic History and Christian-Muslim Relations. And I quote in her article, The Globalization of Islam. And she speaks about Islam in America. And she says, observers estimate that more than 18 nations in Africa, Asia, and Eastern Europe are represented in the mosque communities of the United States. And that these many groups constitute one ummah, or global community of faith. Yet they bring with them a variety of traditions, a variety of practices, as well as a kaleidoscope of doctrines and beliefs, fashioned over time and in alien context. Members of the community are initially surprised at the discrepancy between the ideals they have appropriated and the reality of their differences. Their similar experiences of the West is forging some of them into a community of believers engaged in a process of creating a sense of solidarity through common traditions and seeking common grounds in their quest to provide a comfort zone where they can fashion a better future for the children. Let's take a short snippet from a CNN program where a report of a particular mosque, immediately the response of a Muslim community, particular Muslim community, regarding the September 11th, and see how Muslims react and how they fit into the pluralism that's America. Let's take a look.
It's 2 o'clock, and the faithful heed the call to Friday prayers. This is the oldest mosque in the city of Atlanta. Among the hundreds attending prayers here is Nadira Sabir.
I've always been a Muslim. My understanding of my world, my understanding of myself and my relationship with God is formatted by Islam.
Pliman El Amin is the mosque's religious leader.
Islam is unique because really it's not a religion, it's a way of life. We pray 5 times a day. We have a fasting for 30 days during the daylight hours of Ramadan. It's a faith that involves our whole waking hours. Even when we go to sleep, we go to sleep with the name of God. When we wake up, we are thinking on God, or we should be.
When I'm thinking, when I first go to Juma, to prayers, is I need to relax. I may write in my journal if I get there early enough so then I can concentrate on the people around me and on what the imam is saying.
The world will never be the same again, brothers and sisters.
Today, Imam Hatim condemns the terrorist attacks on America.
I can't even use my imagination to do anything like this. To get inside of the cockpit, to drive the plane inside of a building. Can you imagine what kind of mind that is? This cannot be a human being.
Right.
It was not Islam. I want to mention that to you. It is no way, no form or fashion identified with Islam. That happened in New York was not Islam.
This is Islam. Fair, dark, and every color in between. Different nationalities, different cultures. Asian, Arab, African, Americans, Europeans, all Muslims.
The face of Islam is so multifaceted, so multicultural, so multi-ethnic. There is no one face.
There are more than 1 billion Muslims in the world, 7 million of them in the United States.
I'm a journalist. This story is happening in my country, in my hometown, in my community. Do you want this to go in terrorism or Metro?
Sabir is a writer for Atlanta's newspaper.
The images that we see of Muslims tend to be extremely aggressive, and you have like this Klingon image going. the only thing we've heard are women are oppressed and you know, their men beat them, and you know, they all have like 100 wives and all this other stuff, and they're all suicide bombers.
There are many stereotypes that tarnish all Muslims. For women, wearing traditional scarves.
One of the misconceptions is that women who do dress in hijab are itching to take it off, or itching to put on the stiletto heels and the mini skirt and tease their hair out to wherever. One, you can do that in your house as much as you want with your husband or your friend or your family. Two, everybody really doesn't define their femininity by stiletto heels and miniskirts.
You think this hair works?
Yeah.
Now you said he also cute. Said that black.
For some, modest dress is part of a code of personal behavior. A code that includes no sex before marriage, no alcohol, no drugs, no gambling. These are hard choices in a free society like America.
But that's the challenge of faith. There is no morality if there's not choice. If there's no choice, if there's no choice between right and wrong, then you can't say I'm a moral person.
That's Imam Ramin there we see from the mosque in Atlanta, and a CNN report a few months ago. As you can see from the new snippets at the bottom, it's a few months old. But I thought it appropriate to give an idea of how people fit in and what Muslims think. Let me conclude the session by just saying that a quote from Professor Frederick Denny in his book Islam. Professor Denny is a professor in religious studies at the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Professor Frederick Denny, professor of religious studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder, he says, Muslim visitors in the West tend to become stronger Muslims rather than straying into alien ways. For one thing, North American and European societies have free presses and a higher degree of freedom of association and expression that tolerates dissenting and even radical viewpoints. The presence of these people has brought about the first significant development of Islamic institutions in the West. Muslims comprise the second largest religious community in France now, behind the Catholics, way behind the Catholics, but ahead of the Protestants. There are significant Muslim communities in Germany and in the UK too, as well as Netherlands. In Canada, the Muslim population is well established, especially in major cities. And in the United States, Muslims number in the millions. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll look at one of the grassroots organizations and the kind of work they are involved in right here in Los Angeles and throughout America. Take a break. I'll be here. Make sure you're there. Keep well and be back in a few minutes. Welcome back to Cal State University, Domingo Hills. We're coming live to you on Channel LA 36, on cable television locally and worldwide on the internet. I'm your instructor for the SBS 318 course. My name is Sadullah Khan. If you don't know by now, it's 11 weeks already. For God's sake, remember that. And this is part 11 of a 13-part program or series on Islamic culture and civilization. Today we are dealing with Islam or the Muslim presence in the West. Last week we dealt with Islam via Africa into America, and today we're continuing Muslim presence in the West and dealing specifically now in the latter portion of today's program. We are going to deal with Muslims in the American pluralism, Muslims in the American pluralism, how Muslims from various parts of the world who are here, who are American, who are living here, people who are Americans who are of Muslim faith. In other words, not foreigners, not people who consider themselves foreign, who are as American as anyone else, some of whose origins may be from as diverse communities as the American pluralism allows, from Europe to China to Africa to Far East to Middle East to Canada. So in regards to the presence of Islam in America and the Muslim presence and Muslim involvement and participation in the American pluralism, I thought, let's look at some grassroots involvements and do some case study and look at some of the organizations and institutions and personalities involved at grassroots level. And today we have with us a dear friend, Sabiha Khan, who is the spokesperson for the Council on Islamic Council on American Islamic Relations. Oh man, KCAIR. Assalamu alaikum, Sabiha.
Alaikum salam.
Thanks for coming, and thanks for having me.
Thanks for inviting me on.
Yes, Sabiha has been on. I think you were on the media issue sometime a few weeks ago, or quite a few weeks ago it was. And who would say, Rian, it was section, I think, session 4 or 5, and we are in 11 already. Time really goes. Yeah. Anyway, Sister Sabiha, you are a spokesperson for K, Council on Arab or American Islamic Relations. American Islamic Relations. What is K all about? Give me an idea as to, you know, what is it? What are you about? What is it? What is K?
Well, like you said, CARE stands for Council on American Islamic Relations. And basically, we're a grassroots national Muslim advocacy group. What that basically means is that CARE's mission is to inform people about Islam and Muslims. What often happens because of misinformation or ignorance about Islam, a lot of people don't understand Muslims and Islam, and it often leads to confusion, and often negative consequences happen because of that. But aside from that, in terms of knowing your neighbor, Islam and Muslims, we feel it's very important for a society that prides itself on diversity. Just look all around you. Just in Southern California, you have people from all over the world. It's basically a mini United Nations in Southern California. Yes. And the Muslim is an integral part. And what we want to do is challenge stereotypes. And in essence, that helps everyone. When you challenge stereotypes, you're not just doing a favor for that certain group. What you're doing is really a favor for the whole of society, in that it promotes understanding. And when you have understanding, you have so much growth in terms of community. There's intellectual growth, there's economic, there's political, and there's all sorts of harmony. I mean, that when you have harmony, you're able to go forward as a society. And being Muslim and American, it's our duty to make sure that where we live, where we grow up, where we raise our children, we're integral part of the society.
I noticed that CARE that has all the billboards across Southern California. Is it Southern California or is it nationwide?
Right now, it's Southern California. It's a new program.
Yeah, there's billboards that you have about Spread a Smile or something of that nature, and you have all Muslims there, but all Americans. There's a variety of people which you're talking about.
Right.
You know, so speak to me a bit about that, about the billboards.
I mean, what
was it all about? It gives me an idea that. And there we have it on the television screen there. Oh, even a smile is charity. Yeah, so what is the purpose behind it? What does it say?
Basically, it says even a smile is charity, and we have smiling faces from all members of the Muslim community, and we wanted to show the range of diversity in all of the Muslim world. We have, you know, Asian Muslims, African Muslims, South Asian, white Muslims, just the whole spectrum. And what we wanted to bring out was unity in mankind. Basically, even a smile is charity. We all share that. We wanted to stress the common bond that we all have as Americans. And no matter what faith group, no matter what gender, we're all in the same human family. And it was it's the first of its kind in the nation, and we're very happy that it started in Southern California. And hopefully it brought about what Muslims are about, basically.
So I see you smile a lot.
Yeah. People tell me.
Well, I'm just telling you, what has the response been to that advert? It was very eye-catching. The first time I saw it, I didn't know that it was K, but it just felt good to look at something like this. And then I think the first time you came on the program and I saw there was even small cards given out to people or something.
Right. First they were postcards.
Yeah.
So what we did was it was a little bit different. It was our original design. And what we did was make them into postcards. Mm-hmm. And we had them at Human Relations County meetings, all different sorts of programs, and people loved it. It's a simple message that everybody can relate to, and it's just our honor, the American Muslim community, just to bring it about in a time when we all need a reminder of just the humanity of each person.
Yes. How's the response been to it generally? I mean, general response to it.
The majority of the people were very happy. They were ecstatic that. You know, good news for a change. Some good news about American Muslims. The Muslim as well as non-Muslim public was very, very happy with the whole campaign, and they actually wanted more.
Yeah. I think you spoke early on about stereotyping. I think it's very important for us to understand that sometimes stereotyping is from both sides.
Right.
It's also very important that sometimes in engaging people, it also sometimes people who accuse others of stereotyping them, they themselves are stereotyping the others, and you know, it makes it the general thing of us and them. And as Professor Esposito mentioned, they are us and we are them. And this banner, poster, or postcard, which I put up there now, it's just something which is, you know, it shows that you transcend that. You know that, you know, this is it. This is we. You know, you're not a particular category. You are an American. You are of different backgrounds. Doesn't matter. You are here, and you happen to be Muslim.
Exactly, and that's the message that we hope went across and continues to reverberate across the community, that we are us, you know, we are them and they are us. Basically, we are one community. We want the good of the community just like anybody else.
So what is the role of the, I'm speaking about American Muslim now, I'm speaking about a variety of people who all happen to be American. And this is the question, you know, the development of the American Muslim identity. That you know that you are, ideologically, you are Muslim wherever you may be, whether you're South Africa or in America or in China. You ideologically, you belong to the faith that you are Muslim. But geographically, nationally, you are an American. What is the role, do you think, from your experience being involved at grassroots level with an organization that's so widespread and so well-known? One of the larger organizations in our country, by the way, Islamic organizations. What is the role of the American Muslim according to your institution, your organization, and what do you think?
Like you said, CARE is the largest grassroots organization. And as I was saying, it's an exciting time in America. You know, we see different faces from different ethnicities, religious background, you name it. We have a different person from a country, and that does not bar you from being an American. Mm-hmm. And what CARE
sees, being American bar you from being a Muslim.
Exactly. Yeah. And the people, and that's what we hope to accomplish in making that understanding, that you can be American and Muslim. It doesn't have to be an oxymoron. Mm-hmm. You can be a good American Muslim at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then what we want to see is just to create a strong America, just like any other American. We want to see America that's prosperous, that aims beyond just tolerance. Because I could say, you know, I tolerate you, but that doesn't mean I accept you as a person. Mm-hmm. And we want to be able to show the community at large that, okay, this is what American Muslims are, this is who we are. And, you know, if you understand somebody, then you start accepting them. And so when you have acceptance, then it's easier to go on from there as a community. And the more tolerance, and I mean, the more acceptance that you get, the less, you know, we hear about civil rights being, you know, hammered on for American Muslim community and so forth. And unfortunately, you know, because we have so much work as a community in bringing that understanding to America at large, you know, we've been through obstacles, and one part is defending the civil rights of American Muslims. And a lot of people these days are, you know, I don't want to be critical, but a lot of people are saying, well, it's okay. If it's somebody else's civil rights, then that's fine, as long as I'm okay. But, you know, basically justice denied to one is justice denied to everyone. Yes. And American Muslims see themselves as the vanguard of protecting civil liberties and civil rights in this country. Mm-hmm. You know, the country is built upon equality for each person, and American Muslims are I guess blessed in that we are learning to be in the forefront, because just as if you defend one community's civil rights, then the whole community benefits and prospers from that.
Yeah.
And you know, if one group is marginalized, you know, it just can't be a good thing for America. And one reactive work is for civil rights, and we've been documenting the hate crimes, and
something about the hate crimes. I mean, of course, since September 11th, even before that, by the way, yeah. since the Timothy McVeigh thing, the Oklahoma bombing, for example, September 11th thing just made it now. Has there been an increase in hate crimes?
how do you respond to that? Are you called upon to respond to that kind of thing? And how do you respond to it? What are the kinds of crimes? What are the kinds of issues you're talking about?
Well, you know, one part of CARE's work after September 11th was very reactive because we were in a state of shock, and you know, we really didn't know what was going on. And one thing was documenting the hate crimes, and unfortunately I think the number is over 1700 since September 11 across the nation.
1700.
Yeah. And what we want to do is learn from the vast majority of Americans are wonderful, and I have to say that we had calls coming in that people were so supportive. They're like, they could make the distinguish between madmen and just the average American Muslim. And that really brought a lot of hope in American Muslims that, you know, we are a part of this society and there are good people. Most people are good. And just like you were saying, don't stereotype on other people, American Muslims realize that we can't stereotype the American public. You know, most people are good. And just like we ask others not to stereotype us.
Yes.
It's reciprocal. And
I don't take a call on the line, Sabiha. I take a call on the line. Just say your name and question briefly. Chuck from Woodlands. Go ahead, Chuck.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Chuck.
Yes. The question I have is if the Muslim population continues to grow, I'm in Woodland Hills, and there are a lot of Muslims here. There are Muslim. I have Muslim neighbors.
Yeah.
What sort of institutional changes would Muslims introduce into our system as a consequence of, say, having the political power to do it? I mean, you know, protecting civil rights is sort of a noble goal, but there are practical issues. For example, uniform voting codes, would these be imposed? What about crimes of sexuality, or would we have new crimes of sexuality? Would homosexuals be persecuted, or would what sort of changes in our institutions? What sort of things would happen in our daily lives if the country began to become Islamic?
Yeah, I think I may respond to that. First of all, what would happen if the Christian country become Christian? By the way, they were supposed to, I think it's a very interesting question. I think I appreciate your question, Chuck, and I'm sure you're asking.
Well, things have happened. Because
where in America, for example, Chuck, give me an example in America, in the 300 years of Muslim presence here and 80 years of immigration Muslim presence here, we have not been able to have any real political power so far yet. We don't have a single congressperson, nor a single senator, by the way. We have one mayor that we know of, and a few chaplains in prisons. So I think, very briefly, I think this part of the fear when Muslims come in, they'll cut off the hands of the thief and they will stone the... I think these are biblical things as well, by the way. So let's not be... let's be honest about what we're trying to ask about. If Muslims come here, this is the country, there are rules and regulations, there's a constitution. When you come here, when you vote, you know what you are voting for. You try to uphold moral values to the best of your ability. I'm not a homosexual. I myself don't promote gay rights. Gays want to have their rights. They're welcome to that. I will not perform a gay marriage. My religion doesn't permit me to perform gay marriages. But if gays want to get married, they've got the right to do so. So I cannot impose it on other people. I can express my opinion about things. But this kind of idea that, you know, when Muslims suddenly take over the country, what happens if Jews take over the country? What happens if Orthodox Jews take over the country? What happens if Jerry Falwell takes over the country? What happens if Pat Robertson takes over the country? What happens if the people like David Koresh take over the country? James Jones. So I think we must be very cautious. When talking about Islam, we don't look at the most, the extreme, for example. There are Muslim presence. How many Muslims are there in the country? 6 million out of, 6 to 7 million out of 250 million. I think, Chuck, you shouldn't worry so much about that. Look, you have Muslim neighbors, by the way. Meet with them. Go to the mosques. Go to the centers. See what they're about, rather than fearing. You know, I'm from South Africa, by the way. The Dutch Reformed Church institutionalized apartheid. I don't fear Christianity, though the Christian church in my country endorsed it. I never hated the Christian. I went to a Catholic school. I have no problem with the Catholics. I have no problem with the Christians. People who brought the slaves over to this country brought them in ships called Good Ship Jesus, Holy Mary, as an example. I don't fear when I come over here that, oh, these Christians are... No, separate what happens in history, separate particular parts of the world, separate what is the reality. You are living in Woodland Hills, as you say. There are many Muslims. What are their attitude? Are they coming and badgering you? Are they trying to impose their views upon you? I find many people coming to knock on my door, or from the Christian church, trying to insist I buy some books and so on. I tolerate that. I don't see that as an imposition. But at the same time, I think you must realize that people who are in this country, wherever they may be, for example, in particular here, they are maybe Muslims. And people have morals, values, and so on and so forth. As regards the political setup, we have clear guidelines, what is permissible, what the laws are, what is the constitution, and you abide by that. Otherwise, you would not be elected, you wouldn't come to power. So we need to be very clear, and who will vote for people like that? So we need to be very clear about that. I think Muslim presence is just a presence of people who happen to be of the Muslim faith, who have moral values like Christians, like Jews, like people of other faiths. They happen to be Muslim, and they are Americans. By the way, many of them are Afro-American. So some people may be feared who are prejudiced. What about the blacks take over? Because the majority of Muslims in America are black, by the way. So some may be prejudiced and say, what about the black takeover? You don't hear that very much mentioned because you sound too prejudiced. But it's easy to target Arabs and Middle Easterners because they are now the easy targets. So let's be clear about that. When you say Muslims, majority of Muslims are blacks. Are you going to bring up the issue of blacks? Or is it not kosher right now to mention those terms? So let's be clear how we separate our prejudice from reality. Yes, if Muslims are in your neighborhood, if they are good Muslims, if they are good Christians, good Jews, it's good for everyone. If it can be bad Muslims, imposing Christians or Jews, it'll be bad for everyone. It's not their faith that makes them so, it's what they are and what they do that'll make them so. We have a question that someone asked here, a questioner. What kinds of prejudice have you experienced from people your own age? For example, at school, at work, and so on. They assume you're at school.
Yeah. Little do they know. I've been lucky that I work in a Muslim environment, so it's kind of hard to be prejudiced against Muslim if you're Muslim. But
it happens, though.
But it can happen. It can happen. That's true. Personally, I haven't seen it. I've not experience prejudice. I might have and not know it, maybe in a very subtle way, but for me, just about my daily life, I haven't experienced prejudice, which is not to say that other people haven't. Yes. I know people have gone through hard times at work, mm-hmm. Because they might have been fired because suddenly, the management was scared they're Muslim and they didn't tell them for whatever reason. And, suddenly they find themselves out of work. Or at school, I know that some kids have gone through a rough time because of their names. And I know of some kids who have gotten beaten up. And, if it's not, it can't be acceptable for any group to be, discriminated against like that. So it shouldn't be acceptable for Muslim, American Muslims as well. So it's really, we see it very imperative in terms of making our community, go forth in the right direction.
Yeah, I think from my side, I must say, for example, I'm involved both at UCLA, at USC, as well at Cal State Domingo Hills. And to be very frank with you, there have been reports of prejudice in many circles. I mean, that has happened. And I think after September 11th, immediately after the horrendous act, there was a tremendous outpouring of support. I think Christian, Jewish, and Muslim communities, maybe the leadership, I'm talking about Southern California in particular, unbelievable, unparalleled support and, coming together. In some parts, even some Christian and Jewish neighbors surrounded the mosque and, drove children to school. It was so heartwarming. As an academic circle that I'm involved in, and I'm involved, as I mentioned, at UCLA, USC, as well as here, very frankly, I must say, I've never experienced. In fact, I've experienced a lot of goodwill. Mm-hmm. But this is an academic circle. And of course, you are teaching to students, so you don't find that kind of thing. What I do find, however, is the kind of questions that it's so much prejudice that you answer, what about the Middle East? As if I always say to Muslim people, why do you, when you ask about Islam, isn't the first Muslim come to your mind? Why isn't the first person Muhammad Ali that comes to your mind, who's a Muslim, American, well-known all over the world, well-known as an American hero, well-known as a Muslim hero? Why is Bin Laden the picture that comes to your mind? Why, in my mind, as a Catholic, I think of the Pope, or I think of Cardinal Mahoney? I don't think of Hitler, for example. If I think of the Orthodox, I don't think of the Serbian Milosevic. So I just find that kind of prejudice is there. You know, you're almost guilty by association. You're a Muslim, so the Middle East. Mm-hmm. So, like, I'm not a Middle Easterner. I'm from Africa, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. So, but the poor question is you have to answer, but you in the Middle East, but you Muslims. I mean, I've never lived, I lived in Egypt for some time, studying there. I was in exile for a while there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this kind of thing. So I think... But what are some of the prejudices that you have that have been reported to you people, and how do you respond to it? How do you respond?
Well, we've had workplace discrimination or school discrimination.
What can you do about it?
Well, what we try to do is, first of all, the best way is communication. We find there's a lack of communication from either one side or the other. Maybe the employer doesn't understand the employee or vice versa. And so what we try to do is maybe through talking, maybe through getting the facts, you know, people understand where they stand. And 99% of the time, it's resolved very successfully for both the employer and the employee or student. There are some cases where sometimes you have to, you know, prove that, you know, your civil rights have been, jeopardized. So in those cases, you know, we have to, and people will fight in court in order to make sure that, you know, civil rights or civil liberties haven't been infringed upon. And actually, I have a clip of our public relations director who was talking about a little bit about the cases and just basically about the billboard as well and what's CARE's work in the community.
So let's have a look at this report, Improving Relations.
Hate crimes against Arab Americans. The Orange County Human Relations Commission reported 69 hate crime cases in 2001 compared to 8 a year earlier. Most of them occurred after September.
It does not reflect the overwhelming majority of the community. Those who commit these crimes are the fraction, are a minority. The majority of the community members continue to go along with their lives in a peaceful way, whether they're at school or at work or the general and public. And certainly they are committed to making Orange County a better place for all of its community members.
The Council on American-Islamic Relations stepped up its community outreach programs, including creating billboard campaigns in an effort to create better relations between Arab Americans and the community at large.
Yeah, there we saw some short snippet of both the, the poster, what do you call it?
The billboard.
Billboard. I'm still a second South African English. Billboard. I must remember that. And Riyad Farah spoke about it. Give us some comment on what's all about.
Basically, he was basically expounding upon, what is it in terms of hate crimes in specifically Orange County. But he also made emphasis on the fact that the majority of people of Americans have been supportive of American Muslims, and we're very appreciative of that. And that just shows the importance of American Muslims being a bridge between Muslims and non-Muslims, between American Muslims and the rest of America, as well as American Muslims, America and the rest of the Muslim world. We have this unique position in history that's never happened, in which we can serve as a liaison from the Muslim world to America. There are Muslims in the world who have this misperception that America is bad, and there are some, but a lot of them, we have to realize they make we have to show them that there's a difference between American foreign policy and American people themselves. And like I said, the Muslim community, American Muslim community, is in a unique position to make that distinction. And when we do that, there could only be good out of, making a bridge of understanding between.
Now, how do you hope to build this bridge of understanding you're talking about? How do you anticipate sort of, building that bridge? What?
Well, tiny steps. There's so many areas that we need to work upon. The three major areas that CARE works through is community relations. We work through media, civil rights, political work. In terms of community, what we do a lot of interfaith work. Even we talk to groups as small, you know, churches as small as 50. We go to student groups and talk to maybe 20 people in a room. And just that personal level of meeting somebody else who is American Muslim, it makes a big difference. You realize that there's a human person standing in front of you who has the same goals, same desires as anybody else. And it makes that that connection between people. And then in terms of media, which I work specifically on, is we try to reach out, you know, to maybe during Ramadan, the fasting month, we try to educate the media about what is this month, why is it important, you know, try to be proactive in showing, you know, this is how American Muslim life is. Of course, there's a lot of reactive work these days in terms of making sure that the record is straight about who Muslims are. And especially, and then also we have civil rights. We've worked with different town hall meetings in terms of meeting FBI, INS, because there's a lot of apprehension in the American Muslim community about civil rights, about what's going on.
What are some of the things that are going on? Let me just hear about that. What are some of the things that are going on? Are Muslims being picked up and questioned and locked up? Is it happening? Because the impression one gets, the media doesn't really cover that very much, by the way. Mm. And when people are picked up and they discuss and discussion in on television in specific, it's almost, well, they were all released. Is that the case? What is the reality? Are people being picked up? Are the civil rights being violated? What is the situation?
I hate to be a harbinger of bad news, but the truth is there are a lot of Muslims who aren't citizens yet, or who are just on a green card, who are in jail, and they don't know why, they don't know the names. Their ACLU is trying to fight for making the list known of who is in there. And unfortunately, it's not like on a list of outrageous things right now in the
public. But all those who are held, are there some violation of the paperwork?
Oftentimes it's minor, it's a violation, that's true.
But are there any who are held who don't have any violations? Do you know of any who are being held who have no violations for the paperwork?
And that's what we're trying to find out. There's a lot of secrecy involved right now. And obviously there's going to be apprehension inside the community about what's going on. And so CARE has, you know, worked with other civil rights organizations, including ACLU, to find out who people are and hopefully bring, you know, justice. That the United States is built upon justice. So
tell me, what are the numbers, more or less, of people who have been picked up or locked up?
I'm sure, I think it's about in the hundreds, but again, like I said, nobody knows for sure.
Okay, hundreds could be 200, 300, could be. I heard up to 1,200, I've heard.
Yeah.
Could be around about that. Okay. Now, what are the major areas that CARE tries to help American society and Islam? What are the major areas in which you feel, you know, you try to, for example, I mean, you spoke about the media, informing them, you work with government level. Before I go to that question, do you work very much with Christian and other Jewish organizations? And I mean, do you find Christian leadership and Jewish leadership, for example, rabbis or priests or people in key positions cooperating with you? Are they of any help, or do they come forward of offer help and so on, knowing what you are doing?
Actually, the faith groups have been awesome, basically. We've worked with Christians, Christian leaders, Jewish leaders, Hindu, Sikh, you name it. We've worked with different faith groups and to build that bridge of understanding. And
is it open? Is it very free?
It's very open, and you'd be surprised. They're probably the most supportive people in terms of understanding what's going on. You know, mm-hmm. faith really helps people yes. through tough times, no matter what faith you belong yes. to. And, you know, in terms of interfaith, that's our work. And then, again, like I was saying, with civil rights, making sure that, you know, everything's in order in terms of America's, you know, constitution, because that's why American Muslims are here, because they believe in what America's about, you know, freedom, all the freedoms guaranteed in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights, and a lot of times, like I told you, discrimination in the workplace, and CARE has worked on some some cases in this area, and actually we have another
video footage.
Video about basically what CARE is about.
Yeah, okay, show some, I mean, I have a video, just basically what CARE is generally all about, and then we can have some maybe concluding remarks, and so many questions to go. But we can have a look at the video on
Just overview of what K is all about. Let's go ahead.
CARA has resolved several workplace discrimination issues involving many well-known national companies. When a U.S. Air grounds crew worker was told not to wear her hijab, she called CARA and was ultimately allowed to keep her job and her headscarf. CARA then helped provide Anjum Smith's name to the Senate committee investigating religious freedom in the workplace.
Taking off that scarf would have been like taking off my shirt.
After testifying on Capitol Hill, a grateful Smith passed out CARA pamphlets to committee staffers. Indeed, it's thanks to determined efforts like these to raise awareness. Scenes like this of women in hijab are becoming more and more common, now part of the everyday American landscape. Muslim American women like this Ohio physician.
We feel that CARA makes a difference, that they are showing results within the Muslim community, and they are making us proud to be Muslims, and the fact that they, following Islam and the Quran, are able to make a difference in the society, in American society.
The publication Anjum Smith passed out when testifying before Congress was one of several compiled by CARA. The employer's guide to Islamic religious practices was sent to the largest companies in the United States. The companion educator's guide, which encourages school officials to be sensitive to Muslim holidays and practices, is also having an impact.
They have requested from us a list of major Muslim holidays, and we've sent it to them, and they're putting that on their calendar.
Also, every member of Congress received CARA's annual report on the status of Muslim civil rights in America. All of this is why CARA's internship program is so critical. CARA realizes it's vital to train the next generation to carry the torch into the next century. With God's help, CARA has been able to bring much overdue political clout to the Muslim community. Its executive director sits on the President's Advisory Panel on Civil Rights to the White House Commission on Aviation Safety and Security. It was in this role that CARA was able to convince officials not to use body imaging, an X-ray-like machine that allows airport security to see through clothes to the bare body. Indeed, a letter from President Clinton even thanked CARA for its guidance during the TWA crisis. The group's work no doubt influenced Clinton's speech urging religious tolerance in the workplace, specifically the right to wear hijab at work and to put the Quran on your desk.
Today I'm instructing...
Kindly comment on what we have seen there. I think you went to the highest levels. I mean, you spoke early on about CARA's involvement, and here you see a presentation at the highest level to the government as well. How does the government, first of all, the first question is, before you give us an overview of what's all about that you have seen, how is the government response? I mean, is CARA well received? And
In the beginning, the president came out and he basically gave support to the Muslim community. If you remember, he was in the Muslim mosque right after September 11th, and exactly with George Bush, which was very good. I think it really helped in terms of keeping fears and so forth down. But basically, after that, we started getting mixed messages. We weren't sure what was going on in terms of, civil rights, civil liberties, because secret evidence, which is basically not telling the person who's accused what is evidence against them so that they could be, so they could defend against the evidence, started being used in terms of people who are in jail and so forth. So Muslim community, has started criticizing the presidency right now because we feel that, on one hand, there is no war against Islam, but on the other hand, we're seeing a lot of our charities close down, a lot of our people in jail, a lot of the institutions that we believe are mainstream America have been closed down. And so a lot of American Muslims are feeling hurt and not so sure about what is the message that's coming from the White House. But keeping that in mind, we realize that we have to constantly be engaged with civic society, and American Muslims realize that we need to constantly be part of any, government, Congress, anything to do with America, because we are American Muslims and we have a stake in the future of our country.
Now, one of the things you mentioned early on, one of the terms that you mentioned, and I was going to take you to task on that one there, I think maybe I can do that right now. The idea of empowering, and we spoke about reducing prejudice from one side to the other, and often there's prejudice on both sides, as you mentioned as well.
But as a community, to understand the Muslim community is not like a monolithic community, just one group of people or one culture, one ideology perhaps, but not one culture or one expression. But how does CARE work towards the empowerment? I mean, whatever levels of empowerment there may be, what is the level, how do you approach the idea of empowerment itself, besides beyond the Muslim community, within the Muslim community itself? I mean, because that also needs to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
Might be multifaceted, as you mentioned, that you are doing. What are you doing to empower the Muslim community itself, or the community itself?
Well, like you said, there's a long history of American Muslims, over 300 years in this country. But the most recent wave of immigration, you know, within the last 80 years. So a lot of, we have a lot of new Americans, you know, the first generation, my parents' generation, who came here to study to have a better life. And so with any new generation, you have to learn how the system works so that you can be a productive member of society. And what CARE does is try to empower the individual. And when I say empower, is basically, you know, show people the importance of being part of the political system, because our vote counts, because what happens in the White House, in Congress, affects not only American Muslims, but all of America. American Muslims have the same, worries just like anybody else. You know, good schools, is there, the crime rate, low crime rate,
tax.
Low poverty taxes, not to mention that. And just basic issues that affect daily life, American Muslims. And so what we try to do is help educate the American Muslim community about how it works, what's important, why should we vote, after that, how to vote, things to do with civic life, in terms of civil rights, knowing your civil rights. A lot of people may not know, because they came from another country where they were suppressed in terms of their civil rights. So when they come to the United States, they might not have known the full gamut of what's allowed to them and what's not. And empowering the Muslim community in terms of media, telling people that we as American Muslims have a duty to inform our community about who we are. So, you know, engaging newspapers, writing letters to the editor, writing articles in newspapers. It's very important to be an active member of society. We suffered in that we felt like, and I'll just speak as the whole community, we felt like, okay, if we stay in our homes and just mind our own business, everything will be okay. Well, everything wasn't okay after 9/11, and that was part of the problem. We let ignorance happen. We let, our bubble, we thought it would shield us, but guess what? It burst after 9/11. And so we realized that even more so, to be engaged with the community, because and that's part of a Muslim's duty, to be engaged in the community. It's, you know, first individual, then family and society. And so to be a true American Muslim, you need to be engaged with your own community.
Mm-hmm. And what about internal empowerment? I mean, is externally talking about, but internally, how do you look at that? What role do you play in that? I mean, I involved with religious organizations as well, trying to look at the spiritual, you know. I mean, so maybe your job, but I mean, try to incorporate that as part of the...
Well, of course, since we are an American Muslim grassroots organization, we will follow according to our religion, you know. Mm. That's the whole point, basically, to be able to... And which doesn't mean, you know, you can't be American and Muslim at the same time, like I said. But... And also, like, externally, talking about making sure, challenging the stereotypes that there are out there, educating others, people through church organizations, through Jewish organizations, so forth, through civil rights organization, community organizations, basically to build the community, making sure that people are part of it. I know that a lot of people have joined a lot of clubs that they realize that, you know what, it's time I started being a productive member of society.
Okay.
So CARE helps enhance and maybe gives a push to the community to realize that.
One of the problems we have with recent immigrants, I mean, talking about the second and third and fourth waves maybe, after the 1920s and so on and so forth, specifically those coming from the Far East and from the Middle East in particular, that there hasn't been a complete integration somewhat, it seems. That somewhat, some of them still have the... Of course, there are cultural expressions. But unlike the earlier Muslims who came here, the African Muslims who came here, or the European Muslims who came here, or the early Middle Eastern Muslims who came here before 1900 and 19, before that time, those who came in the 20s and after the First World War and so on, that many of them are strongly cultural, which almost identify them as something separate, even within the Muslim community, by the way. Mm-hmm. Do you find that that's sometimes an obstacle that people somehow still, some of them, I mean, I'm talking about the recent immigrants, have the mentality that, you know, I'm here, but that is still home, and that needs to be overcome in order for them to become truly effective and productive members of the society. Do you find that to be true?
Well, if we look at American history itself, we notice that with all groups, with all immigrants, you know, there was the Germans, there's the Italians, and African Americans, and so forth. So it's normal. It's just a human tendency to stay with people you know, you understand. Mm-hmm. The challenge is to learn how to break away. I mean, it doesn't mean you can't go back to your comfort zone of people who you identify with. But it also means that there's a challenge in terms of breaking away to be able to make your own ground, make your own, you know, be part of American society. We look all around us. You know, America's not just about different minority groups all stuck in under one country. We're diverse in thinking, in ethnic, in different ways. But we're also, America is a country where all of this comes together. And it comes together beautifully. I mean, we are the world's leading country in terms of economic, political, etc. Mm-hmm. And so American Muslims, I think, are realizing that you don't have to be separate. I hate the term melting pot, but that's what we are ending up to become. That doesn't mean we don't keep our identities of who we are. Never, you know, disregard who you are just to become part of something. Keeping who you are as well as being part of the society.
And I think, you know, what you are is what you are, but also is what you become in the process and how you contribute to a becoming. You know, you can always be a Christian, always be a Muslim, always be a Buddhist, or whatever it may be, and you may have certain cultural tendencies and backgrounds, but how do those varieties contribute? After all, America is a melting pot, as you mentioned, and specifically Los Angeles, by the way, is the most cosmopolitan city in the world, for that matter. And I always tell my class, you know, in this class, if I ask a typical American to stand up, you'll be surprised. There, you know, there's a variety. You know, I have Japanese students in my class, Arab students in my class, students from the Gulf region, students from Mexico, from Canada, Afro-Americans, Africans, and so on and so forth. I'm the only South African there, by the way, but there's something else. Any parting comments, last comments before I let you go, Sabiha?
I think we are in a special time. American Muslims are going to have to make the effort, and the American community make the effort in terms of bridging, understanding, making understanding, learning about one another. You know, the benefits will be countless in terms of once we understand and realize that, you know, we have a common goal. What's our common goal is basically to make life better for everybody, for our generation and the future generations, and learn how to work together. And I think the sooner we realize that, sooner we work on it, the better we are all for it.
Thank you very much. That's Sabiha Khan from Council on American Islamic Relations at last. CARE, I just need to say it, CARE. Thank you very much for some insight into what CARE is doing and an example of what Muslim involvement at grassroots level in this part of the world and part of the American pluralism. Just for the benefit of our students, the assignment, which is the major assignment for the grade for this course, it's an essay on Islam in America. The essay will be Islam in America. And I want a reference to the universality of Islam, the basic overview of the Islamic contribution universally, also the history of Islam in America in particular, the diversity of Muslims that are found here, the growth of Islam in America, and of course, the dilemma faced by Muslims vis-a-vis stereotyping and media bias somewhat, and specifically since September 11th, and also the need for understanding and acceptance. I repeat, the theme is Islam in America. Essay of approximately 2,500 to 3,000 words, about 7 type pages, hopefully. Write an essay on Islam in America, making reference to the universality of Islam, history of Islam in America, diversity of Muslims found in America, the growth of Islam in America, the dilemma faced by Muslims in America, especially since September 11th, and the need for understanding and acceptance. The due date for the assignment is May the 7th, 2002. That's this year. May 7th, 2002. And the following considerations will determine the grade. Is the paper well researched? Originality? Does the body of the paper adhere to the goals put forth in the introduction? Linguistic and grammatical propriety? Is the conclusion based on information presented in the body of the paper? And of course, neatness, and of course, delivering the assignment on time. So due date, May the 7th, 2002, the essay Islam in America, 2,500 to 3,000 words. It should be in by May 7th. I thank you once again, Sabiha Khan. We'll be having a break right now, and we'll be coming back with another guest. And don't go away. I'll be here, and I hope you'll be there too. Back after the break. Welcome back to Cal State University, Domingo Hills. We are live on Channel LA 36, which is a cable TV, and as well as worldwide on the internet. I'm your instructor, Sadullah Khan, for the SBS 318 course in the Social Behavioral Science Department, and the course is Islamic Culture and Civilization. We are in session 11, and the theme for today has been Muslim presence in the West. And of course, we dealt with the history of the Islam in the West and the various encounters, as well as, for example, the first one, very much in the life of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, with Islam going to Africa and receiving refuge under a Christian king in Africa. And then, of course, the Crusades. And thirdly, the colonization period, where many of the Muslim lands were colonized, both in the Middle East, in Africa, and the Far East. And then, of course, the immigration after World War, with Muslims immigrating to various parts of the world and being present as minorities as well in many parts of the world. Thereafter, we looked at Muslims in American pluralism as part of Muslim presence in the West. And we're looking particularly at grassroots involvement of organizations well known in the Muslim community and well known in the general community in their areas, but not necessarily known beyond that. So we want to bring to the attention of our audience and to our students as well, and to the academia, the significant role played at grassroots level by organizations which are essentially educational, social organizations working for social welfare, social improvement, and so on, but also who happen to be manned and womened or personed by Muslim people. And in that way, Muslims contributing at a grassroots level to the American pluralism. We have with us a dear friend, first time on the show, from Ilm Foundation, Brother Naeem Shah. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Welcome, brother.
Thank you so much for having
me. It's great to have you.
Yes, it is. I just want to thank you for having the show, and all your contributions has been very enlightening, and I just wish you and all your staff the best.
Thank you very much. I have a great staff behind you. Always see you in front of you. I see you met some of the guys at the best. They're a great team.
Yes, sir.
And really, we enjoyed it very, very much. You represent the Ilm Foundation. Ilm, of course, means knowledge in Arabic.
Right.
But what is the Ilm Foundation all about? Where are you located, and what is it all about?
Well, the Ilm Foundation, like you said, is first, the word Ilm is knowledge, but it's a 501c3 nonprofit organization. And we're located in the Exposition USC Park area. And
downtown LA, man.
Yeah, right there, South Central. And in that area, you know that the poverty level is severe poverty. There is a lot of gangs. There's a lot of alcohol. There's a lot of people who are just struggling to survive. So out of that climate, we just felt it was obligated for us and the founders to start something to assist the environment to try to become more stable. And that was the context in which the Ilm Foundation was started in. And
I think we have we are with Brother Naeem Shah, who is the Chief Financial Officer of Ilm Foundation. That means if I need money, I come to you.
You could talk to me.
So, Brother Naeem Shah from the Ilm Foundation. Let's take a short snippet of one of the videos of the Ilm Foundation, so I have an idea of what they're doing. And then I would ask you some questions, and you can comment on that.
Okay.
Let's have a look at the video snippet.
I'm new to Islam. I've only been in Islam 3 years now, so it's very important for me to learn more, to get a broader view of what's going on, to be in a more comfortable environment outside of the masjid, And, you know, to fellowship with the sisters and the brothers. I work on Friday, so I don't often get out to Juma. So it's very important to have this class on Saturday for me to come and fellowship with everyone and increase my knowledge of Islam.
Well, it's give us a lot more knowledge about and the understanding about Christianity, and also more knowledge about Islam. I learned a lot about Christianity that I didn't know in the first place, because we, most of us was born and came up in the Christian church as Christians, but like my part, I never could get any understanding. Nobody would never explain nothing to me about certain different things about the birth of Jesus and Mary and all of this, and all they would tell me was read the Bible and believe. And, you know, but that wasn't enough. I mean, when somebody, you know, you want somebody to explain something to you, I mean, and tell you the reason why that these things are happening.
I'm just here to learn more about Islam and further my knowledge in the religion. I've been Muslim for 4 years. Everybody needs to come together. I think non-Muslims need to hear more about what Muslims believe, because there's a lot of misleading out there.
The M Foundation was a process, in the sense of going through an effort. We first started out really just trying to have a dawah venue, and we actually were working on publishing some books. The concept came out of really trying to establish a website, and then not understanding the in-depthness of a website, it takes some time. So we understood that we had to try to have something that can also sustain us. So we actually tried to do a concept of a bookshop, you know, having the bookstore, and also having the oils and so forth, and also having classes here, because there's no social venue for Muslims. So Muslims come here for social venue. They come here to study. They come here for research. They come here just to meet each other. And we actually wanted to eventually get into a cappuccino setting. We have part because we have all this space. So this has been really a process. And actually, the Elm Foundation itself is just based upon really dawah. Our whole premise is just dawah.
What type of classes do you offer here?
Well, we have Islamic study classes. We also have classes in economics. We're also going to have classes that really deal with the basics, essential of education for the community. Like, we're trying to get a few more computers, for have computer classes for the community children who really don't have the ability, some of them, because it's a very deprived environment here. I think it's 51%, 61% is low income. So we want to have classes where they can come and learn the basics of computer, because it's important for them to be computer literate. And also the current trends, in a sense, as far as the welfare and so forth, we want to bring people in so they can inform the people what are their benefits, how to take advantage of. So we want to provide a service for the community that really links us together, in the sense of being accountable and responsible for each other.
How have the Muslim community and the non-Muslim community responded to your organization?
It's overwhelming. I think because there's never a charge here. I mean, for example, the classes are free. People have akikas here. Muslims have akikas. They have workshops. They have classes. And we just try to make sure it's accessible to Muslims and also for the community. The community is very comfortable. They come in and sit down. They come in and enjoy it. And I think it's been something that has been tremendously supported, because I think it really allows all of us to come together in a sense of mutuality, in a sense to where we see each other first, in a sense of in a common way, to where we have the need for each other. And I think that's what's important.
What would you say is the ultimate goal for the M Foundation?
Oh, we would like to have a lot of M Foundation. I wanted to say the younger brothers, it's really mainly the young people. You know, you're talking to me, but I have had very little to do with this. Actually, Hanafi, Naeem, Ahmed, and several others, many more others, have worked and sacrificed, left jobs to work in this. And it's the young people I'm so impressed with, because they have vision and they have energy, you know? And the thing is that I'm here, but really I'm not the important one here. The important one here is the way that they work together and they continue to sacrifice for what they believe in, and that's what I'm impressed about.
We're doing a comparative study on Islam and Christianity, and it's been wonderful, marvelous actually, to see the oneness of Allah in both Quran and in the Bible. You know, but a lot of the things that are in the Bible obviously have been overlooked by many.
Actually, when I grew up, I was agnostic for the longest time. And at first said atheist, and just to be careful, said agnostic. But I've been studying religions for, actually, I was a religion major. So I studied religions all my life. And finally, Islam at least gave me the concept of God that I had always believed in.
First question comes to my mind. Imam Sadi Sabir mentioned you there, so right. Why weren't they interviewing you?
Well,
I'm doing the job right now. Am I right?
That's right.
What I find very interesting is very often, I'm involved in community work as well,
mm-hmm.
and very often the community funds, the community itself funds the programs. Now, in a community like that where you have 61% low income, how do you manage? I mean, I looked at that facility, it looks really good.
Right. Faith. Sacrifice. No, what I'm saying, it was a tremendous sacrifice.
I have faith in our book, man.
Yeah, to establish it. It really took a lot of faith, a lot of sacrifice. A lot of the founders, like Imam Sadiq was mentioning, left jobs. Imam walked away from a job that he started for 15 years as a pest control owner. I walked away from, I'm a CPA, so I was working for Arthur Anderson.
Before Aaron Rodgers. Okay.
And but these jobs wasn't really affording us the desire that we wanted to fulfill in the community. They was giving us a comfortable life, but in a sense of really trying to be a forerunner in the community, we know we had to free ourselves and to reestablish some economic roots based on our work. And it did take a lot of sacrifice. We're still trying to recover from it. But at the same time, when we see the impact on feeding people, the impact on women's child getting computer services, it takes all that away. And we just...
Much more rewarding.
Much more rewarding.
Now, how is the foundation structured? I mean, it seems to be very well organized. And I mean, first of all, it's not a well-paid job, that's for
right,
sure.
Right,
I mean, how is it structured?
Well, the structure...
And how is it financed, by the way?
Okay, well, the structure is very similar to, I would say, how Prophet Muhammad, in a sense, may peace and blessings be upon him, established his relationship with some of the youth in Medina. We know that him as being an educator always worked with some of the Ibns. These are the juniors. These are the son of some of his companions. And at that time, while he was educating them, they were getting cultivated with the religion at a very young age. So when they grew up, it became very natural to them. Our structure is very similar. 50% of the M Foundation staff or 60% are youth under 30, under 25. But we're using this energy we combine with the hikmah or the wisdom of the director, Imam Sadiq. He has about 25 years experience at this work, and we're able to have an excellent consultation, someone to talk to through each trial that we may have through it to kind of inculcate endurance. Mm-hmm. His wife is also part of the structure, who has Isha Safir, a tremendous amount of marketing experience. Mm-hmm. Ahmed Shahi is a technical support system that we have. Hanafi Shakur's deals with our publications. My wife Kiyama deals with some other outreach for the community. So everyone has a role or a universe that they don't try to overlap the other. And we have confidence in each other. We've all students of the religion. And that makes a lot of good chemistry in terms of our structure. Finances, we just now really try to apply for grants. We are a 501c3. We do believe that our services are just as compatible as others who are performing the same work out there. But when you say there's a lot of money, there's grants, it's a process in terms of trying to get those funds. Yeah. So we've learned, we have good relationships. We've endured, we have a record in the community. So we just think it's a matter of time for our ideas to come in contact with the resources to really show the community the additional services we want to provide.
Now, what programs have you established? I mean, I see some information teaching people computers and so on. Mm-hmm. But what are the programs? You know.
Well, the programs are really again. I'm gonna go back to kind of like the structure for a second. We have two structures: ICRA, which is dealing with education, because we know that our mission is teaching life skills to replace social ills. And in terms of trying to replace a social ill, we know that it starts off with education. Correct knowledge should precede correct behavior. And the other aspect is Ma'um, which deals with providing neighborly needs. Mm-hmm. Now, on the Iqra side, we deal with...
For our listeners, viewers, Iqra means to read in Arabic. It's the first revelation Prophet Muhammad received. So Iqra is the reading part, I think, the academic and intellectual advancement. And the other one, it's intellectual empowerment. And Ma'un means seeing to neighborly needs. There's a chapter in the Quran called Ma'un, chapter 107. So the title of the two major programs, Iqra and Ma'un, read, and the other one is neighborly needs.
Beautiful.
Neighbor. So go ahead.
Beautiful. And so on the Iqra, under education, we have a multitude of programs. First one is dealing with interfaith, Partnership for Humanity, where we go to different churches, synagogues, mm-hmm. and really just share the basic of Islam. We're finding out that a lot of the friction is because people really simply just don't know. Also, we have, under that particular program, we provide a lot of books and tapes. We have a video library of about 20 different videos. We have cassette tapes over about 100. And also, we have a lot of other excellent things under our Dawah department. We have classes. We offer the community about 300 hours worth of classes. So if you come to Masjid Ibadallah or any place where we're doing classes,
I've been there.
You're going to have a lot of enlightenment. We cover subjects from science to the issue dealing with Palestine to all type of topics, especially family issues. Then the other side dealing with, like you said, Ma'un, our community service. You know, in Islam, prayers aren't for anything if they don't also accompany our social responsibility. In that, we have two main programs, Eat Right to Think Right. That is our free food program.
I like that.
And what we're really trying to do with that one, last year we were able to feed 10,000 people for free in our community. That was going down to the homeless once a month. This program is sponsored also by Islamic Relief. And the other program is called Going Beyond the Game, Youth Academic Incentive Program. And in that program, we work closely with the Omar Ibn Khattab Foundation, trying to provide youth computer skills, after-school tutorials. We take them on college tours. And in fact, we did a survey last year, and 90% of the students that we took never seen a college campus, but they live across the street. They live right down the block, but they've never visited the college campus. They never seen the library. So we told them that we would take them to the game, but in order for you to go to the game, we got to have 4 hours of going to the library and different things like that. And we give a camp every year, a sports camp, and they get a chance to meet some of their sports stars. Last year, Oz Akeem plays for the Detroit Lions, well, now plays for Detroit Lions. Last year, played for St. Louis Rams, sponsored the whole camp for free. But out of that, a parent said that by her child being introduced up close to his favorite superstar, Oz Akeem, who emphasized education, he started doing better in school.
Okay.
So we're trying to use these different methods of enrichment activities, after-school support for those single parents to try to really offer the best chance for the child, not just to do good in school, but have the inspiration to endure a college 4-year curriculum and keep that momentum going in the workforce and into society in general.
Excellent. Now, how do you feel this work is important to the community? I mean, obviously, just lay down for me, like, you know, it's so obvious in some ways, but just maybe something that I may not see. How do you feel is important to the community?
Well, I think it's significant to the community. I mean, the communities, what I'm talking about, are very deprived communities. We live in a society where there's very prominent areas. You know, you got the Bel Air, the Beverly Hills. And sometimes we become detached because it's not always seen of the homeless standing outside living in cartons. And since 9/11, we went out there. Before 9/11, we saw about 10. Since then, we've seen about 100. So, and in the community that we were serving, we have education. Most of the schools in our area, they're also being afflicted by potentially being state controlled. The reason, because they're not passing basic standard test scores. We're seeing single mothers, again, working two jobs, not even having enough to feed their homeless. So the importance of the work is probably way more than we can even measure. And we know it's too much work to do, to even enough for the M Foundation to fulfill. But we know the little bit that we can do, we're obligated by our religion to enjoin what is right, forbid what is wrong, to supply neighborly needs. The first thing the Prophet did in Medina was feed the people. After he built the mosque, he fed the people. So we're seeing it's first of all being an obligation from our religion. Second, we're seeing the impact of just supplying human rights, of shelter, food, clothing, these basic things so a person can have basic peace. And if we don't participate our part, then we're going to find our community as well as the other communities also afflicted by conflict just because they're trying to survive. So it's extremely important, we feel, our work.
What are some of the challenges that your organization faces besides the financial one, obviously?
Yes, I say the challenges are a lot. What I mean by that is, as Muslims, we have a history. When you're talking about grassroots, I would say this history of being participants in grassroots started way back, like you were talking about in some of the sessions before, with slavery. I mean, we've been involved with trying to make sure of being issued justice because we've been victims of injustice. So this started a long time ago. But in a sense of seeing it in the civil rights period and the importance of trying to deal with the challenges of being deprived certain rights. But even so, now you're looking at Muslims not really being active. We've somewhat isolated the community service to the masjid, where we have this social dynamic with each other, but when it comes out to the community, we haven't been as active. So the challenge is both internally and the challenge is externally. Internally, I think, is a feel of just trying to mature the community to become, to get back out into the community. Right now, most of us grown up in a particular environment, but now the environment demographically has changed. The children have definitely changed. The attitude has definitely changed, and it's a reflection of the major blight. It's because there's been no leadership in the community. So I think our challenge is getting over and trying to implement the principles of the religion that emphasize participation, that emphasize removing those ills, and that comes through, first of all, the teaching. The other challenge, in a sense of trying to deal with the resources, is that Islamically, we don't have a sense of some of the same injustice that we're seeing outside, we're seeing inside our community, where we have have and have nots. We have communities that are very prominent, but at the same time, you have communities that are struggling to survive. So some of the same injustices that we're seeing, we're trying to remove outside, we're trying to also deal with it in the internal community by not having some of the basic pillars being practiced, like zakat, which is a major pillar to remove some of the
economic
infrastructures, and as you know, that the wealth should circulate. So that has been a challenge. Most of our resources have not come from Muslims. That's why we were forced to expand our ability to become recognized in other sectors, establish our credibility in those sectors, so we can also petition for the same funds as churches, as other nonprofit grassroots organizations, which is solicited through the city, the county, the state, and the federal government. But when I look at the churches, for example, I'm looking at someone or an entity that has really exploited this opportunity. You have churches in our community who have budgets of $35 million a year, mainly from community-based programs providing housing, providing food for people, providing employment. And yes, we're not upset at that, but we have a desire to compete.
How many million do you have?
Zero. But we have $1 million worth of blessings. But we want to definitely translate into providing some of the same housing and senior housing that we're seeing others provide. We want to provide that too for the community, not just Muslims, but the entire community.
How has the community responded, speaking of the community? I mean, the Muslim and non-Muslim community, how has the community responded to the Ilm Foundation's efforts? I mean, how has their response been to this campaign?
It has been really good. It has been really good. I think that the community really respects anyone who's trying to shoulder the banner of trying to remove ills. They know that it's a sacrifice. They know that it's not a highly glamorized position. It takes a lot of tremendous sacrifice, a lot of tremendous effort. And for example, at the mosque on Jefferson and 4th Avenue, where we have one of the outlets for the food program, we've been feeding the community for about a year, where they come 2 days a week and also on the weekends to provide food for their families. Right after the 9/11 event happened, we didn't really know what to expect. But going outside that Friday was another feeding, we had the same amount of people come, if not more. Their response was like, if that's terrorists, we're not worried about that, because what you're providing us is a basic need, and we know you. Mm-hmm. We appreciate your support. Mm-hmm. We feed some of the gang members' mothers. So in terms of trying to create a peaceful climate where the mosque is protected and other people are protected, we're seeing that as based on really them getting to know us through services. And that has really made the response really good. We're finding a common denominator to really get to know each other. That's really based on providing these basic essentials.
Living in the area which you have mentioned, the issue of gangs being around there and so on, how does the gang activity affect what you do, and how does what you do affect the gang activity?
Well, I think it affects us tremendously. We're in a community together. They have a stake in the community, maybe in a different situation. We have a stake in the community. There's been over 30 homicides in our community recently from different gangs problems. But not just looking at the gang situation, we have to look at why there is a gang situation. What are the roots to the problem that produced the gangs? And until that's addressed, then the problem on the top is not going to really change. So we have groups out there that we work with. One group is called Stop the Violence, Increase the Peace, that deals with gang truce, try to make sure that at least there's an amicable relationship where no one innocent is victimized. We have a great security team at the masjid that's in contact with them. So there is somewhat of a dialogue, but until you can remove some of the problems that they're afflicted with,
the roots,
the family structure that they've been deprived of having a benefit from, the economic conditions that they're being raised in, the lack of literacy, which has to also be there, then it's very tough just to point the blame or all the problems to them like that. I think we have to do a lot of work as a community to make sure that we can address the root causes before we can just...
Have you been able to speak to some of the gang members and somehow resolve some of the issues in some way?
Not directly, but we are planning a town hall meeting. And we're trying to become more active in a sense in the community and trying to really deal with that sector. And I think that hopefully going into the next few months, we're going to have a good agenda to try to really interchange with a dialogue with them. I think there's been some activity, but it hasn't been enough to really measure at this time.
What about some of the social work dimensions of, for example, abuse, spousal abuse, for example, or child battering, or spouse battering, husband or wife battering, for example, or unwanted pregnancies that may be in the community? Do you find that very common? And is it in the Muslim community as well, or is it you helping people beyond the Muslim community in that regard?
No, I think it's in both communities. I think that we, of course, as Muslims, we have a doctrine that would, if we had lived to it, it gives us the strength and the restraint to avoid some of the pitfalls in which others may not have. But when we don't adhere to it, or maybe not properly raised or educated, then we can also find a lot of Muslims victimized by unwarranted pregnancies, by abuse, by not really understanding the proper role that they should play in a relationship and not adhering to the role that's prescribed in the religion. Again, I think it goes back to education. I think that we can't expect to not be victimized by some of the same ills that exist outside as a community if we're not living according to the religion inside the community. And we're finding out that we are being victimized, not just on a local level, but on a global level. A lot of the global issues are also a result of us not adhering to some of the basic principles. And I think that this is a test for us to be tasted and hopefully to turn back. But these are the ills. These are the social ills. And again, I believe that the camps, the enrichment activities, really trying to assist the single mothers, like with the welfare issue, they're changing the laws to the point where they're going to have requiring more work. The Bush is trying to pass a bill to require more work from welfare mothers up to almost 70 hours a month or 40 hours a week. And these with infants, with children, they're not increasing the child care funding, but they are increasing the more demands from the mothers, but also separates them from the home, which also increases neglect and can cater on to this cycle of abuse.
That's so, what happens when rich people make laws for poor people.
Yeah.
That's what happens when rich folks make laws and regulations for rich people among rich people regarding the poor.
Exactly.
How is the non-Muslim community in particular, I mean, obviously the Muslim community is the majority mm-hmm. in the area there. How has the non-Muslim community responded, number one? Number two also, second part of the question is, obviously you don't, are any of your services only for Muslim, or is things open to everybody? I mean the feeding and so on. Mm-hmm. Has anything to do with people's faith, or is it across board?
That's a good question. The first question, the non-Muslims are responding extremely well. I think this is a kind of a unique experience for them interacting with the M Foundation, in a sense of us being very sincere, not having any hidden agendas. We're open to all, like at our camps. I think they were shocked to see so many, what would be characterized by the media, African-American young males that weren't gangbanging, that weren't in jail, that weren't talking, cursing, actually spending some time with their children. I think they were really shocked to see that. And
how many people did you have, by the way?
About 67 kids. And we didn't say that it was a Muslim camp. We didn't do anything to promote Islam, but of course, Naeem, they know it's not a common name, Hassan, Hakeem. So,
sometimes you never know. You know, if I look at the media, Shaquille O'Neal, is a Muslim name.
Right.
I don't know if he's Muslim. I don't think he's Muslim. But Shaquille.
I'm not sure.
Then you have Alia, you have Aisha, Khadija.
Yeah.
Common names on TV and singers and Shakira.
That's
these are all Muslim names, by the way. So.
The conduct. So it's been good. It's been good. I think we have a big role to play.
What about the feeding scheme and so on? Is it open to non-Muslims?
Oh yeah. It's open to non-Muslims.
Nothing.
It goes back to the religion again.
Yes, of course.
Back to our roots. And that's why I like, instead of grassroots, I like faith-based a little better, because the faith-based really shows that we're coming from a particular doctrine. Even though we don't proselytize in our services for the community, we still have a moral foundation. And that foundation does not allow discrimination. It does not allow us to be racist. It allows us to accept anyone.
Chauvinist.
Yeah, no chauvinism. In fact, a lot of our sisters in our community, they do speeches. They're involved just as much as us. And so it's really balanced. And I think that they're seeing an Islam that they haven't seen before. You know, they know Islam just by Muslims. We pray, we fast. They know about the Hajj. But they have yet to see our social reform impacting the community. And I think once they get a chance to know this a little better, then they're going to really start to appreciate Islam as a really an asset to America versus a threat.
Yeah, there was one question before. I got two questions left. Anyway, time is almost up.
Okay.
And we should have had more time. But how has September 11th affected the Muslim community and the Ilm Foundation as a Muslim organization in that environment?
Well, I think 9/11 was a tremendous test in a sense of for the Ilm Foundation. I think for every Muslim in general in the population, and as any test, we know that's from God, from Allah, that it's going to grow you is for the benefit, even though that the event in itself was a wrong act. We are very sorry for all the harm and the lives that have been lost. But at the same time, there has been fruits from the event where we had an opportunity to visit a lot of places and received a lot of open ears about Islam that we wouldn't have had an opportunity to hear, I don't think, as quickly as the event brought to fruition after. We've been to Jewish synagogues, we've been talking with Catholics, we've had invitations to a tremendous amount of places, and these have become friends. We've ate over their homes, at their houses, and we know each other intimately.
It hasn't happened before.
Never happened before, not like that. Mm-hmm. And for the social aspect, and then the challenging has also been, you know, dealing with the misconceptions that have intensified, of course, because of the media. But I think us working together and unifying that we can counter that. I think this show is a good example of countering some of the negative things that are not necessarily always backed by facts in the media. And I think that that is the one negative thing that had happened, but again, we have ways to counter that. So the M Foundation has been very active. The work, the load has increased tremendously.
So what are your future plans? What are your future plans?
Really to get more involved. We really are trying to get more funding to really establish some of the services that we do. We would love to have a youth center. We think there's not enough social activities for Muslims or non-Muslims, but especially Muslims. The youth have nowhere to go. So we're working on Proposition K to get a youth center established in the community, but not just for youth, but for the whole family. We want to see the seniors working more with the youth.
And
the
mentor kind of thing.
Yes. And for our Dawah department, we have about 4 to 5 books that we're real close to finalizing, books on psychological effects of slavery. We have a marriage books. We have about 10 assortment of books, just small ones on different Islamic concepts. One of our books was actually instituted at an Atlantic seminary, a seminary in Atlanta, the Christianity and Islam book that was a required text in their course. So we're working on a second edition to that one. So the future is very bright for the M Foundation. Our test is always just trying to stay as close as possible to the religion, as close as possible to the example of what I feel who was the greatest reformer that the world has ever known, that's Prophet Muhammad. And if we're able to exemplify that to just an inkling in the community, I really feel the future for the foundation is positive, and the society constituents that we can serve will hopefully be benefit as well.
Brother Naeem Shah, thank you very, very much. I think we have been very much enriched by your being here, and of course, real grassroots. I mean, we talk about the roots of the grassroots here. Really about the roots of the grassroots.
Definitely.
Really, I know some of the things that you are involved with. I've been to the Ibadullah Mosque, but I would like to avail myself of whatever I could do.
Thank you.
I think the community has been much better informed, the audience, and as well as the students, at an academic level, as well as the human level, as a social level. So this is a lesson in more ways than one, not just academic, but also social, and also moral, I think, besides. I want to thank Brother Naeem Shah. He is the...
thank you.
What's the title? They said that... Chief Financial Officer of ILM Foundation. I was asking for some funds, but I think he requires some funds.
That's right.
Chief Financial Officer, thank you, Brother Naeem.
Thank you very much.
Very much inspired by what
thank
you have said, really. And
I thank
you for that kind sentiments.
Thank you.
And we hope you everything the best. And may the community benefit from your presence. And, really those people who most need it.
Thank you.
You are fulfilling a tremendous responsibility. An example of what can be done as human beings when they consider themselves as human beings, as moral beings, as social beings. After all, we are moral beings, and after all, we are undisputably or indisputably social beings. And the more we acknowledge our responsibility towards society, the more we qualify as human beings, I think.
That's right.
And really, Brother Naeem, I appreciate
thank you.
Whatever you're doing.
Thank you.
God bless, and all the best for the future. And I hope the fundraising goes well.
Thank you.
As well.
Thank you very much.
I just wish to bring to the attention of the class, of the students who are taking the class for credits, that the assignment, let me get my glasses. I've aged since this first session is now the 11th session. A major assignment due on May the 7th, 2002. That's this year, next month, but this year. May 7th, 2002. A 2,500 to 3,000 word assignment, about 7 pages at least, on Islam in America, dealing primarily with the subtopics, the universality of Islam, history of Islam in the USA, diversity of Muslims found here, and the growth of development of Islam in America, dilemma faced by Muslims in the USA, stereotyping and some of the media bias, but more specifically September 11th, and the need for understanding and acceptance. Thank you very much. See you next week. I hope you enjoyed it. All the best.